listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Takes on the World News.
This is Jeff Blankford doing Takes on the World, a program on international affairs. It comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. On Monday, hundreds of thousands of Iranians marched while some burned U.S. flags to mark the 40th anniversary of the triumph of Ayatollah Khomeini, the Shia cleric who toppled the U.S.-backed monarch of Iran, Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, in the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Scarcely mentioned in the U.S. media was that the Shah had been installed as the country's ruling monarch, it being the intended result of a coup against Mohammad Mossadegh, organized by the CIA against the country's democratically elected president in August 1953 for having the temerity to take control of its oil industry from the British. Like all the other coups arranged by Washington following the end of World War II to this day, no apologies to the countries and their people seen as threats to U.S. global ambitions and consequently victimized by our intelligence apparatus were ever forthcoming or demanded by either the American people or those they have elected to represent them. And now, thanks to the oversized influence on President Trump of American Jewish mega-donor billionaire Sheldon Adelson, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the United States seems to be moving once again to overthrow a government in Tehran. Not surprisingly, this has not received the attention in the media that it deserves, even though many of the same forces that pushed the U.S. into invading Iraq are engaged again against Iran. This is what I will be examining today, 20 minutes past the hour. Until then, I'll provide a perspective on the controversy surrounding the vicious attacks on the Somali-American congresswoman from Minnesota, Ilhan Omar, who had the temerity to call attention through a post on Twitter to the outsized campaign contributions by American Jews to members of Congress to maintain their support for Israel. But first is news alert. The truth is anti-Semitic, and it will no longer be allowed on Capitol Hill without carrying a warning similar to that placed on cigarette packages. That will say, caution, those telling the truth about the relationship between Israel and the United States and the influence of pro-Israel Jewish money in determining U.S. Middle East policy will not be able to use the facts supporting her, his, or their case as a defense, since it is clear that these facts are, by definition, anti-Semitic. This is all so ridiculous, as Glenn Greenwald said Monday on Democracy Now! It's all based upon this demand that we indulge what everybody knows is an utter and complete fiction, which is that we're allowed to talk about the power of the NRA in Washington, we're allowed to talk about the power of the Saudis in Washington, we're allowed to talk about the power of big pharmaceutical companies in Washington and Wall Street and Silicon Valley and the fossil fuel industry in Washington, but we're not allowed to talk about an equally potent, well-organized, and well-financed lobby that ensures a bipartisan consensus in support of U.S. defense of Israel. At the minute that you mention that lobby, you get attacked as being anti-Semitic, which is what happened to Congresswoman Omar. And I think the context here is really important, he says. For a long time, according to Greenwald, the bipartisan piety was not just that the U.S. has to support Israel, but that in particular the effort to boycott Israel in protest of its occupation of Palestine is not just misguided but anti-Semitic. That's the official position of the Democratic Party, of Hillary Clinton, of Chuck Schumer, of every leading Democrat, said Greenwald. And now suddenly you have these two really exciting, dynamic, charismatic women of color, new elected to Congress, the first two Muslim women elected to Congress, who both are supporters of the boycott of Israel, which the Democratic Party says is bigotry and anti-Semitism, and it's created this very awkward moment. How weird it is, notes Greenwald, what a priority is for U.S. politicians to defend Israel, so that the very first bill passed by the U.S. Senate was not about helping Americans. It was about empowering states to punish people who support a boycott of Israel, a bill sponsored by Marco Rubio, who got more money from Sheldon Adelson than any other politician in 2016, and then was supported by half of the Democratic Senate caucus. And the congresswoman was saying, a big reason for that is the moneyed interest in Washington that demand that. And of course, writes Greenwald, everyone knows that's true, and to call that anti-Semitic is just obscene, end quote. as Glenn Greenwald on Monday's Democracy Now! It is not only money and the promise of votes in key cities that used to control Congress. It's also fear. If there was a secret ballot, aid to Israel would be cut severely, a congressman described as pro-Israel told the pro-Israel New Republic's Morton Kondracki back in 1989. He said, it's not out of affection anymore that Israel gets $3 billion a year. It's from fear you'll wake up one morning and find that an opponent has $500,000 to run against you. End quote. It is one of the worst-kept secrets in American Jewish politics that the campaign contribution is major key to Jewish political power, wrote J.J. Goldberg, editor of the Jewish Weekly The Forward, in his 1996 lengthy work on the issue named Jewish Power Inside the American Jewish Establishment. Strikingly, wrote Goldberg, almost none of those involved in the process of Jewish campaign funding, donors, fundraisers, candidates, monitors, are willing to talk about it on the record. But it is a fact, wrote Goldberg, citing a 1990 study of the voting records of 130 senators between 1970 and 1982 that, quote, a senator's likelihood in voting in a pro-Israel manner, backing arms sales to Israel, opposing arms sales to Arab states, resisting administration efforts to pressure Israel, rose in direct relation to the amount of funding received from Jewish sources, end quote. And then he goes on, given the outsized role that Jewish money plays in Democratic politics, says Goldberg, writing presciently in 1996, much less attention has been paid over the years to its growing role in Republican Party finances, end quote. How far the Republicans have come was revealed in the 2016 elections, before which Sheldon Adelson, the Jewish billionaire who owns Israel's most widely read newspaper, Israel Hayom, held two sets of auditions for prospective Republican presidential candidates at his Venetian Hotel in Las Vegas to see who had promised the most for Israel. When his first choice, Ted Cruz, was eliminated, he switched to Trump and became his and the party's and Trump's biggest funder in the 2016 campaign. It was Adelson who pushed Trump to cancel the Iran nuclear deal, to move the U.S. embassy in Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, to fire his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, and his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, and replace them with John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, respectively, because they were against the Iran nuclear deal and more pro-Israel. What Adelson and Bolton have most in common is that they both have publicly advocated the bombing of Iran, with Adelson specifying that it should be nuclear. It should be obvious that the shadow looming behind Trump's recent rejection of the U.S. intelligence organization's downplaying of a threat from Iran is that of Sheldon Adelson. In 2010, he proved that his first loyalty is to Israel by declaring to an audience of American Jews in Israel his regret for having served in the U.S. Army and not that of Israel. It's something I've mentioned before on Takes on the World, but you're not likely to hear or read about it anywhere else, despite the fact you can still watch him saying that on YouTube. That no Democrat Party official nor the media has mentioned this is no doubt the fear of the same vilification now being experienced by Ilhan Omer for speaking the truth that cannot be spoken. And there's more. In 1996 and 2000, Mother Jones Magazine, using figures collected by the Center for Responsive Politics in Washington, published an article headlined as the Mojo 400, which contained a link to its website of the 400 names broken down into industries of the top major donors to those presidential elections for both political parties. For an article I was writing at the time on this very subject, I went through the list for 2000 and found that 7 of the first 12 leading donors were Jewish, as were 12 of the top 20, and at least 125 of the first 250, at which point I stopped counting. 75% of the donations went to Democrats, but what was most striking was the massive disproportion in contrast to the low single-digit percentage of Jews in America's population of those funding our political campaigns. When the article was published in an anthology by Counterpunch Books called The Politics of Antisemitism, Mother Jones did what I should have anticipated. It removed the link from its website because my analysis of the list was apparently not intended for the eyes of the general public. The same can be said for a conference held in Florida in late November and early December by the Israel American Council, an organization of which I assume you have never heard of because, again, it's not for everyone. That Vice President Mike Pence spoke there in the absence of President Trump was only mentioned by the Miami Herald, and the first people he greeted on taking the podium was the ubiquitous Sheldon Adelson and his wife Miriam. Their tax-exempt $13 million contribution to the Israeli-American Council has made the organization, founded in 2007 by Israeli-American billionaire and Clinton funder Haim Saban to bring Israeli-Americans together as a political force, into a, quote, right-wing complement to AIPAC that it only wants certain people to know about, like Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. The leaders of the Democrats in the Senate and the House were interviewed on stage at the same conference by Saban about what the Democrats capturing the House in 2018 elections meant for Israel. Here is a short clip of Pelosi explaining to Saban and the audience how her appointment of the campaign chairs to a string of key House committees has put all the ducks in place, not for the benefit of the American people, but for Israel. At the end of the clip, Schumer chimes in to emphasize the importance to Israel of the appointments of fellow New Yorkers Nita Lowey and Elliot Engel to key congressional posts. Here it is.
I am, since Chuck was bragging about the Senate and what they're up to, I want to revisit your other question about what we do in the House as we go forward with this new Congress. And I want you to take great pride in the fact that Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was here in a bipartisan situation, is a what we call a cardinal, a Jewish cardinal in the Appropriations Committee. The cardinals, they are the chairs of the committees. She has a very important position on appropriations, which is where this bill of funding for Israel takes place. Two people were going to be here. Lois Frankel is on the Foreign Affairs Committee. Alcee Hastings on rules, but he's our top person, our chairman of the Helsinki. And that's important in terms of anti-Semitism as well as pro-Israel initiative. Ted Deutch from this area is the chair of the Middle East Subcommittee of the Foreign Affairs Committee. The list goes on. Nita Lowey is the chair of the Appropriations Committee, the first woman, and a big supporter of Israel, as you know, strong Israel-U.S. relationship. Elliot Engel is the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee. Adam Schiff is the chair of the Intelligence Committee. So we have people very well placed to share our values in terms of the heart and the Israel in heart and Israeliness in spirit. Shared values. Remove all doubt in your mind. It's just a question of not paying attention to a few people who may want to go their own way. But as far as our Congress is concerned, we try very hard to unify, to have bipartisanship in all of this.
Can I just, Chaim, one thing? If you probably look in the House of Representatives, the two most important committees for Israel are Foreign Affairs and Appropriations. And you couldn't have two stronger supporters of Israel, both New Yorkers, than Nita Lowey and Elliot Engel. So the House is in very good shape to be really strong for Israel this year.
Amazing, no? You never hear it any other place but Takes on the World. That was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Charles Schumer, the highest-ranking Democrat in the Senate, during their duet for Israel in December with Haim Saban, a naturalized Israeli-American billionaire who several years back proudly told a New Yorker interviewer that he was a one-issue man, that one issue is Israel. The first committee chair Pelosi mentioned in that clip was Debbie Wasserman Schultz. The Florida congresswoman, who you may remember, was forced to resign as head of the Democrat National Committee when the emails released by WikiLeaks revealed her to have rigged the primaries on Hillary Clinton's behalf against Bernie Sanders. No penalty box for her from Pelosi. Taking pandering to a new low or high, depending on your perspective, she also told Saban and the audience that, quote, if this Capitol, assuming she was referring to Washington, crumble to the ground, the one thing that would remain would be our commitment to our aid. I don't even call it our aid, our cooperation with Israel. That's fundamental to who we are, end quote. If there is any good news on that front, is that polls show that young Democrats have been deserting the party's traditional pro-Israel stance in droves. It explains why the senators thus far in the Democrat presidential chase but one, Amy Klobuchar, including Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, both with close ties to the pro-Israel lobby, voted against the legislation passed by the Senate last week, 77-23, reinforcing decisions by 26 states so far, making the boycott of Israel against the law. At some point down the road, they will all have to choose between their funders and voters. In that regard, a Google survey commissioned this week of 1,000 U.S. voters by the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, when asked the question, should Congress force American businesses seeking government contracts to first sign a pledge that they won't boycott Israel for its human rights record and military occupation, 75% said no.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. The most effective way to challenge the distortions, myths, and outright lies of the Israeli narrative, which drives American policy, is to present the historical, documented facts which we describe as the Palestinian narrative. This Week in Palestine systematically tries to present that narrative each week, well-researched, well-documented history, and the analysis and opinion which flows from that history. And no one is more reliable in that presentation of the narrative than new historian Ilan Pappe. That is why we feature him so often on this program, and why we do so again this week. So our extended feature presentation is Professor Ilan Pappe speaking in Sydney, Australia, where the Jewish lobby was unsuccessful in their attempts to prevent this lecture from occurring.
Professor Pappe, Ilan has paid a significant personal price for his commitment to truth and justice. The management, as I mentioned, at his university undertook a process of persecution that was aimed at expelling him from his position. Please join me in welcoming Professor Pappe.
And thank you all for attending this lecture. I want to thank the organizers. I know it took some effort and persuasion, and finally I'm here. This is my first talk, so it'll still be, the impact of the jet lag will probably still be recognized, hopefully not for too long. What I would like to do is to talk about one of my latest books, which is called The Forgotten Palestinians. And through that concept of the forgotten Palestinians, hopefully say something more general about the situation in Israel and Palestine. Needless to say, of course, as the discussion would be opened up, I would be very happy to engage in a conversation not only about the particular topic I'm talking about, but on Israel and Palestine in general. In the mid-1950s, David Ben-Gurion, the first Prime Minister of Israel, was out of office for a short year and a half due to internal political struggles within the then hegemonic dominant Labour Party, and the position of Prime Minister was in the hands of Moshe Sharet, who most of the time was the Minister of Foreign Affairs. But just for a year and a half before the Sinai campaign, he was the Prime Minister, and Ben-Gurion went to voluntary exile in his kibbutz in the Negev's, Deir Boker, and had more time, as he wrote in his diary, to go around the country and see the people, which, when you are as the Prime Minister, I suppose you have less time to do. And one of his tours in that moment of political lull was one of these trips was to the north of Israel, to the Galilee. And he visited a military compound, a high school, a new factory, several kibbutzim. And all in all, it seems, at least according to the diary, that the day was quite satisfactory. But one thing clouded the day. One thing made the day not such a pleasant day, he wrote. There were too many Arabs in the Galilee. He didn't realize that. And I think that is very important because Ben-Gurion, as a prime minister, of course, was engaged with the question of Arab-Jewish relationship in the newly born state. But there is a difference between seeing something as a living experience and conceptualizing an issue as part of a strategy. So as part of a strategy, he knew that a very small number of Palestinians all in all remained in the Jewish state after 1948. But then concentrating in the trip in the Galilee, which was one of the few areas in Palestine where relatively the number of Palestinians was still high in the 1950s, he saw for the first time the incomplete result of what I called in one of my earlier books the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And he found it troublesome because Ben-Gurion in the mid-1950s believed that those Palestinians he had seen in the Galilee were a fifth column, were potential traitors, potential collaborators with the enemy. And this led him to take two strategic decisions which he will implement when he will come back as a prime minister in the early months of 1956. The first was not to let off the military regime that was imposed on the Palestinians in Israel immediately after the 1948 war, because quite a few people, including his nemesis, Menachem Begin, the leader of the right-wing Herut party, strongly advised the prime minister to abolish the military rule. He said it doesn't stand to reason that so many citizens of a state would be under a military rule, and definitely people on the left asked him to abolish it. But after trips like this to the Galilee, he was sure it would be a fatal mistake not to continue a very ruthless and callous military rule in the Palestinian areas within the State of Israel. So that was one strategic decision. And only after he would leave politics altogether in the mid-1960s, will the military rule on the Palestinians in Israel come to an end. You really needed to remove Ben-Gurion from politics to abolish that military rule, and I'll come back to the military rule in a moment. The second strategic decision he made was that the Galilee, especially the Galilee, needed to be Judaized. He there and then conceived, I think, the idea, which became later on a governmental policy, of initiating a project which is called the Judaization of the Galilee. All kinds of red lights blinking here. I hope it's not the Israeli Secret Service or something. is this significant or not? You don't think so? Okay. I had a traumatic lecture tour in America where all kinds of Zionist activists used all kinds of tactics to try and disrupt talks, so I thought maybe this was something like this. Anyway, the Judaization of the Galilee was not just a theoretical concept. He immediately set up a committee, and a very important person in that committee is the present-day president of Israel, Shimon Peres, how to make sure that the demographic balance in the Galilee would be dramatically shifted. The numbers he had in the 1950s were very alarming, and that what led him, I think, to write in his diary there were too many Arabs. It was not just a kind of an intuitive impression that the Galilee is full of Arabs, and not only that the landscape, and indeed the landscape of the Galilee then looked more like an Arab area with the Palestinian villages and so on compared to many other parts of what used to be Palestine and became the state of Israel. But demographically, in the 50s, 50% of the people in the Galilee were Palestinians. And he found that almost suicidal. And then he decided to set up this committee in which Shimon Peres was a particularly important figure. And their plan, which he approved, was to build intensively Jewish settlements all around the major Palestinian villages and towns in the Galilee. And to build them in a way that would disrupt, as they called it, natural continuity between the Palestinian habitats. The worst kind of threat in their eyes was the only Palestinian town, Nazareth, which was a very small town during the mandatory period. The reason it became such a relatively huge place was because it hosted most of the refugees from the Palestinian villages around it, and it tripled in number compared to what it used to be in the mandate. And one of the first initiative was to build Upper Nazareth, an urban sprawl that was meant to strangulate the Palestinian city of Nazareth and to make sure that it does not expand in any geographical way, which it didn't until today. The number of people in Nazareth tripled since 1948, but the space remained the same. And that somehow these two strategic decisions to continue military rule in those areas and to Judaize the Galilee, on the other hand, set the Ben-Gurion's mind to rest. The end of this story is, of course, that if you form today the first Jewish town within the project of Judaization, that is Upper Nazareth, if you form the municipality there and you ask them how many Palestinians reside in this town, which is supposed to be purely Jewish, ideologically and strategically, they would say none. And then you would say to them, but, you know, I've just toured Upper Nazareth and I've seen quite a lot of Palestinians. And then they would say, all right, but we're not at liberty to depart with such information. And the information is that almost 30% of the people who live in that town, which was meant to strangulate the Palestinian town of Nazareth, 30% of the people who live there are Palestinians. So I think that if Ben-Gurion would have been alive today and made another tour to the Galilee, it would have been even more awful than that trip back in the 1950s. The situation of the Palestinians inside Israel is important not because they are forgotten. So I thought it was good to write a book about a particular Palestinian community that is usually excluded from the political and historical agenda of the Israeli-Palestine conflict. That was good enough reason by itself to focus on that community. But there was another reason. I think that it is exactly the kind of attitude that Israel developed throughout the years as an official organization, the state, and the society alike, the kind of attitudes that developed towards the Palestinian minority inside Israel are a very good indication why it is so difficult for us, even those of us who are long-time activists and definitely those of us who are students of the topic for so many years, why is it so difficult either to provide a clear definition of the nature of Israel, or even if we are convinced that we know the answer, whether we use apartheid or settler colonialist state or whatever we use, or even democratic state, if some of us still do that, why it's so difficult to convince others to adapt our definitions. And one of the main reasons for this fluency in the definition is the relationship between the state and the Palestinian minority, because they are treated much better than any other Palestinian group. There's no doubt about that. And yet they live under very unique circumstances that actually prove, at least in my eyes and the eyes of many other critical observers, that that defining Israel as a democracy would be wrong if one takes the case study of the Palestinian minority as a litmus test, as a test for this assumption. Because most people would say, yes, because Israel occupies the West Bank, it cannot be defined as a democracy. But I'm saying no, it's exactly because, not only because of the occupation, it is because of the way the Palestinian minority is treated that we should have questions about and challenge the assumption that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. And of course, defining Israel as the only democracy in the Middle East is the basis for the Western and American, especially American, support for Israel, and is the main immunity shield that allows Israel to pursue its policies comparatively without any official pressure and criticism from the political and economic elites of the West. So the best way to examine the very unique circumstances in which the Palestinian minority in Israel lives is just to do a short tour into the past to understand how the current reality in which they live materialized. And I think a lot from that history can be, a lot of what we can learn from that history can help us understand better the reality today. And it really connects to many questions that I know trouble us as a community of activists. For example, the question of a one-state or a two-state solution is closely connected to the fate and the future of the Palestinian minority in Israel. What kind of Israel would be there should there ever be a peaceful solution is also connected to that question. But far more profound questions are also, hopefully, will come out from such an historical journey. For instance, whether Israel is a Western European entity in the midst of the Arab world, or should it be part of the Arab world, part of its problems and part of its solutions. And much of what the Palestinians in Israel have to offer has gives you an idea of where can it go from here. Because for the present, what we have is, of course, an Israeli-Jewish political, intellectual, and cultural elite that wishes to maintain the Zionist dream of creating a kind of a Central European Republic in the midst of the Arab world. Most Israeli Jews still have this dream of an earthquake that would take Israel away from the Middle East and append it to, hopefully, to Norway, but if it's not possible, if it's not possible, at least to Italy. I think they will be content with Malta, but I'm not sure about that. And this is the kind of reality which they could have faced better had they had a different kind of relationship with the Palestinian minority inside Israel. So let me just do the brief historical journey, and hopefully these two or three main themes that I mentioned, the one state, the two states, Israel cultural identity, and the question of democracy. I hope these three issues at least will come out very clearly. As probably most of you know, when we talk about the Palestinians in Israel, we talk about the group that was left intact, in a way, inside what became the State of Israel. It's important to remind ourselves that the State of Israel was founded on 80% of what used to be mandatory Palestine, 80%. And in that 80%, about 1 million Palestinians lived. Out of the 1 million Palestinians, only 100,000 or so remained. So, first of all, we're talking here about a group of people who lost, within few months, 90% of their own community. And one can only imagine, unless one went through it personally, I can only imagine the trauma of such a dramatic transformation in one's life. Now, it was not just losing your community, it was, of course, witnessing how the landscape changed from being Mediterranean, if you want, Arab, in certain places Islamic, and how it suddenly transforms into a kind of a modern version of settler colonialist communities around you. At least a quarter of these people were refugees in their own homeland. They were expelled from their villages and towns, but were not expelled outside the boundaries of the newly formed Jewish state. Now, one has to understand that being a refugee then within the State of Israel meant watching very closely how your former house, your former field, your former shop is being taken by others and being rebuilt as a Jewish settlement or as a Jewish factory or as a Jewish farmland. And sometimes probably for a refugee to see this is far more traumatic and painful than living in exile somewhere, not knowing exactly what happened to the land or the house or the business which used to be yours. There are several poignant cases, but I particularly think of one particular neighborhood in Nazareth which was built after 1948, was not built actually, was re-inhabited by a new people because those people who lived there originally were expelled. And they re-inhabited a new, an old neighborhood that was exactly above the village that was occupied in 1948, destroyed, and rebuilt as a Jewish settlement with an old Hebrew name. And, of course, the first thing you do in Israel of the 1950, you bring the archaeologist. And the first piece of clay that they find is enough to convince everyone that there is an eternal scientific proof that this used to be a biblical town, and therefore actually this was not expulsion and ethnic cleansing, this was a redemption or redeeming an ancient place. The place I'm thinking about is Tzipori, and the name of the village is Safuria. And the name of the neighborhood that overlooks Safuria is called Safafra. So you can see, even if you are not speaking Hebrew or Arabic, how these names are all four names are connected. But the traumatic experience watching your houses and real estate and whatever was in it looted and taken by others was not, of course, the only difficult aspect of being a Palestinian in Israel in the first 20 years of statehood. The most difficult one was to be subjected to the military rule, which I've mentioned before. Now, the military rule is an interesting outfit because it was devised by the British in the 1940s. These were actually mandatory, British mandatory emergency regulations, which the British imposed mainly against the Jewish undergrounds in the 1940s. In fact, some of the Israeli politicians who imposed these regulations on the Palestinians in Israel called them in the 1940s, or resembled them in the 1940s, to the Nuremberg Laws of 1930s. But somehow this comparison was lost in history when they were reimposed on Arabs. When they are imposed on Jews, they are Nuremberg Law. When they are imposed on Arabs, there are safety measures. And those of you who have been to the West Bank and the Gaza Strip don't have to use much imagination in order to realize what the security regulations were all about. They are the same features of military rule that are being experienced by Palestinians in the West Bank today, which gives any junior officer in the army absolute control of the civilian life. The soldiers are the judges, they are the executive, they are the legislative, and they have absolute control in your life. I do think that the military rule of the Palestinians inside Israel was worse than the military occupation of today, because the military rule, or the apparatus of the military rule in the 1950s and the 1960s, was manned by soldiers who were very much on the margins of the Jewish society. Everybody who was not considered to be useful to the Israeli army in any other mean was sent to govern a Palestinian community. So they were quite depressed people, and they vented their frustration on the Palestinian community in ways that are very cruel, but also sometimes very bizarre. And those of you who have read, because I know it was translated into English, the lovely novel by the late Palestinian-Israeli author, Emil Habibi, the optimist, can have a humorous view on that particular life. But even with his humor, the pain comes through. One of the most ultimate kind of use of force under such circumstances was a massacre in 1956 in Kafr Qasim, where 49 people were massacred by these kind of soldiers. But this was just the tip of the iceberg. On a daily basis, human rights and civil rights of these Palestinians were violated within Israel, that already then was depicted in the West as the only democracy in the Middle East. I noted before that this kind of military rule, which I describe in my book, The Forgotten Palestinians, of course, in more detail, and I'm not the only one, even several good personal memoirs who have just come out lately, that give an in-depth into that period. I mentioned that this period in the life of the Palestinians in Israel came to an end when David Ben-Gurion was no more in power, and that's true. But there was another reason why military rule in Israel and Palestine, in Israel, ended in 1966. There was another reason. And the reason was that, contrary to the conventional history of the June 67 war, that sees it as an event that sort of springs out of the blue. The common narrative of the 67 war is of an Egyptian leader, Jamal Abdel Nasser, who tries to create a new coalition of radical Arab forces, whose one of their aims is to destroy the Jewish state, and Israel has to preempt his attempt to eliminate the Jewish state in June 1967, and miraculously the Israeli army defeats six or seven, I don't remember, Arab armies and so on. I'm sure you're familiar with the, if not, you can ring the Israeli embassy 24 hours a day. I'm sure they will give you a bite sound that would satisfy you. Well, it's part of the story. I'm not saying that this is totally false, describing it in such a way. But another part of the story, which is very important, is that the Jewish leadership was very much disappointed from not occupying the West Bank in 1948 when it had an historical opportunity to do so. And ever since 1948 was looking for a pretext to occupy the West Bank. And it was very clear, and now that the documents are open, it's even clearer, that in 1966, it was in the air that such an eventuality is about to happen. Nobody knew exactly whether it would be June 67. Nobody knew exactly that Nasser would do what he did. But there was a preparation ever since the mid-1960s in Israel to the eventuality of occupying the West Bank. And there was also already a strategic plan ready. That's why the Israelis so quickly, I always was amazed by it. I was already then witnessing it with my own eyes, how quickly the Israelis were controlling the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The answer is they were ready for it about 3 or 4 years earlier. But what was important, that in order to envisage the possibility of what you do after you occupy the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, you had to envisage what kind of mechanism will you use to control it. And it was very clear that what you needed was to transfer the military rule imposed on the Palestinians inside Israel and use it for controlling a new group of Palestinians, namely those of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And most of the people who were in high positions in the military rule that controlled the lives of the Palestinians inside Israel would be the first to operate the same military rule with the same emergency regulations in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip immediately after the end of the June 1967 war. So the military rule comes to an end when it's clear that another group of Palestinians is about to be under Israeli control, because this is the history of Zionism. It has a demographic dimension and it has a geographical dimension. It needs a successful Jewish project or Zionist project in Palestine is about space. How much of Palestine do you need to exist? And how many Palestinians inside that space can you tolerate to exist? Now, the more space you want, the more Palestinians you have. The less space you have, the less secure you feel. I'm not testing now whether these are good assumptions or bad assumptions. They're just part of the Zionist catechism. And this being Sunday and the opening of the Jewish New Year, I thought it would be good to be a bit religious. And so it was clear they are going to take more land with many more Palestinians in it, and they needed to know how to control it. So, in a way, the Palestinians in Israel benefited from the new strategy to expand the borders and to digest an additional number of Palestinians as part of the citizens, as part of Israel's domain. Then the Palestinians and Israel became a topic for strategic discussion among Israeli politicians of how to proceed without the military rule. Because the military rule is a very clear tool. How do you control a quarter of your population, whom you suspect of being a fifth column, who you don't regard as an integral or organic part of your nation, and whom you really would like to see disappear? And yet, at the same time, and this is also genuine, at the same time, you do wish to be a democracy. You do wish to be a democracy. You do wish to be humane in your treatment. And even if you don't have these two impulses, to be democratic and humane, you want to be seen as such for the sake of getting American aid and diplomatic support from Australia all the way up to Washington. And that's a problem. I mean, that's a big problem. Now, one thing is very clear. The basic attitude between of the state and the society, unfortunately, at large, to the Palestinian minority in Israel has not changed. And there's so many surveys and censuses that are being conducted on a yearly basis, sometimes on bi-monthly basis, that show that this has not changed. For the vast majority of Jews in Israel, and for the vast majority of those who are at the center of policy making in Israel, the Palestinians of Israel are an existential problem. And the best solution would have been if they wouldn't have been there, but it's impossible, of course, to achieve that. So this kind of tension between what you want and what you can do is very indicative. What also comes clear is that the Israeli policymakers, legislators, academics, security people think that the best way to go along with this dilemma is to work all the time on two levels. One is the potential level, and one is the actual level. The potential level says that in the value system of the state, its existence dwarfs any other value. Namely, if at any given moment any kind of development in the relationship between the state and the Palestinian minority would endanger the existence of the state in the eyes of its policymakers, then every means is justified, including the ethnic cleansing of that population. And this was clearly stated even by Netanyahu in this famous Herzliya conferences we have in Israel. Herzliya is a kind of an old people's home for university professors who don't know how to retire. So they build a private university for them. But they're very prestigious, and they get all the people in the land to come and give them speeches about their programs. And they talk there about the Palestinians in Israel as a demographic bomb or demographic problem. The noun changes, but the message is the same over the years. So potentially, every Palestinian who lives inside Israel as a citizen knows that they are on probation. Their existence in the state is conditional, not so much based on their behavior, but how their behavior would be perceived by the authority. For instance, when they demonstrated in support of the Second Intifada, the Israeli government decided that the police can stop such demonstrations with shoot-to-kill policy. 13 Palestinian citizens paid with their life. And it worked. Since then, you don't have massive Palestinian demonstrations. But of course, they can erupt again. But this was a red line. You cannot demonstrate on such a level anymore. And there are all kinds of other issues. I don't have the time to go into it, but maybe in the Q&A session we can expand on it. But I want you to understand that this is the kind of trick that Israelis play, what I call the potential reality. In the potential reality, the Palestinian citizens of Israel have no citizenship, have no basic human and civil rights. But in real life, they do. They do. But it can take between 1 minute and 10 seconds, or 10 seconds to 1 minute, to change from one situation to the other, because the military regulations of Israel are still intact. And according to the military regulations, any military officer at any given moment can declare an area where Palestinian citizens live as a military zone. And the moment it's a military zone, all their basic human rights and civil rights are gone. It doesn't happen very often. It doesn't happen very often. But it's possible to do that. So we are left with the real life of being a Palestinian in Israel, not the potential threat, but of course one cannot separate the two. On three levels, Palestinians in Israel cannot be regarded as full citizens. And this absence of full citizenship is indicative to all the three questions I raised before about Israel being a democracy, the one-state, two-state solution, and the cultural identity of Israel. On the legal basis, Israel has a set of laws that directly discriminate the Palestinians in Israel in any aspect of life. Now, this was not very apparent until about 15 years ago. In fact, the official legal discrimination was not very visible. For some reason, and again, I don't have the time to go into it, ever since 2000, there is a new intensity of legislation that totally made redundant any effort by scholars to understand whether Israel is an apartheid state or not. They probably knew about our predicament and decided to start legislating in such a manner that forces me to burn some of my previous books and my previous articles. There's no need anymore for any elaborate kind of deconstruction. No, we don't need Michel Foucault anymore for understanding why Israel is an apartheid state. The less visible aspects are in the executive, if one can put it this way, the way that budgets are distributed, all kinds of social privileges, development plans. I've already mentioned the fact that Nazareth cannot expand, but this is true about any Palestinian area. In the 64 years of Israel existence, 500 new Jewish settlements inside Israel were built. Not even one Palestinian village was allowed to be built, let alone expand. But there's a similar discrimination in school budgets, health education, and so on. The trick, before the legislation made it clear, the trick was to connect this kind of government assistance in building or developing an infrastructure to service in the army. It said that if you serve in the army, you are entitled to all these things, and because the Palestinians do not serve in the army, that's why they are discriminated against. Not because they are Palestinians, but it's not true, because also the ultra-Orthodox don't serve in the army, and rather than being discriminated in budgets, they are overcompensated in budgets. So that doesn't work that well, and the few Palestinians who do serve in the army, like the Druze and the Bedouins, cannot testify that such an agreement brought any improvement in their living conditions either. So that doesn't work. And then the third level is probably the most important level in many ways, is the invisible ceilings and glass walls. And I don't think in this respect the Palestinians fare differently from any minority group in any societies. But the interesting thing is, from a scholarly point of view, that the only literature you have in order to compare what Palestinians in Israel feel when they face a judge or a tax collector or the security person in the airport, that the only literature we have is that of immigrants, especially immigrants of the last wave. But we have to remind ourselves that the Palestinians in Israel are not immigrants. The state immigrated into their life. They did not immigrate into the state. And therefore, I think this is far more problematic in the kind of relationship that develops between the Palestinian minority and Israel. I would try to conclude here because I really want to open the floor for as many comments and questions as possible by saying that in the Oslo process in 1993, two very important Palestinian groups were forgotten. The Palestinian refugees and the exilic communities on the one hand, and the Palestinian minority in Israel. Because this is the basis of a two-state solution. It has to think of Palestine as being only 20% of Palestine, and has to think about the Palestinians as being only 50% of the Palestinians. Now, there are many among us, some of them are very good friends of mine, who believe that this is realpolitik, that you have to accept it, that the Palestinians are actually only those who live in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and that Palestine, what can you do, can only be these 20%, namely the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and you won't have a solution if you don't accept these two reductionist perceptions of what is Palestine and who are the Palestinians. But the Palestinians in Israel, like the refugees, will not disappear, even if you'll have a two-state solution tomorrow. And I think that this is the most important part of the story, that the predicament, the tensions, the violations, the inhumanity, the historical mistakes and atrocities that were triggered by a noble idea of Jews who wanted to save themselves by colonizing Palestine, that all these historical chapters would not be dealt with properly if we will continue to think that Palestine is only the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and if we will continue to exclude the Palestinian refugees and the Palestinians in Israel from a prospective solution. It's almost like someone who has a disease all over his body and you tend to his hands or legs and you say, yeah, I know the heart is not working too well, but until he dies, he will have good use of his two hands. That is not a solution. That in many ways, it's quite a torture rather than a solution. There is no way of squaring circles. There cannot be a Jewish democratic state, there cannot be an Islamic democratic state, and there cannot be a Christian democratic state. There can be a democratic state. And if you may not think highly of democracy, and I won't blame you given what we've all experienced, but let's say that we are willing to settle for a democracy as a good political system, or the lesser of all evils. If the Palestinians in Israel and in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip and those who were refugees will not be entitled to equal civil and human rights, there will never be a democracy. However you're going to partition the land and repartition it or federate it or confederate it, you will have to go not to the geographical issue but to the rights issue. And the price for the Jewish community is going to be very high, undoubtedly. A democratic Israel will not be a Jewish state. That's true. So this is something that Israelis would have to come to terms, because all their attempts to square the circle by saying we'll be both Jewish and both democratic, the history of the Palestinians in Israel proves that it is not possible. And sometimes in life you have to make a choice. And you have to ask yourself, what would you like your children to be in the future? Citizens of a democratic, free state, or citizens of an apartheid Jewish state? These are the only two options.
That was Israeli new historian Ion Pape speaking on the forgotten Palestinians in Sydney, Australia. We are out of time, and that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We hope you will join us again next Sunday when we will return to our coverage of the Jewish lobby's assault on campus free speech. We will hear about two reports that were published last year documenting the systematic attempts to silence the Palestinian voice on campuses, criticizing the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and promoting the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. That is next Sunday on This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Devon-based British Constitution Group monetary reform campaigner Justin Walker and me, Tony Gosling. Shamima Begum wants to come back to the UK after supporting ISIS in Syria. But who was it that groomed her online and lured her out there and paid for her to get across Turkey down and across the Syrian border? Why have hundreds of fighters already returned to the UK without being questioned? And the BBC demonising Russia again. Khodorkovsky, the oligarch, is sponsoring an anti-Putin group in Russia. But that fact goes unreported by the BBC. So we take a closer look at Lloyds Bank's so-called business support unit here in Bristol, based in the old Bank of England Bristol office on the edge of Castle Park. Avon and Somerset police have come under intense criticism for not properly investigating evidence of alleged fraud at the Lloyds BSU. Their bait and switch technique allegedly has been pushing borrowers into toxic debt they can never repay. But it's not just Avon and Somerset police who are accused of not investigating Lloyds Bank. The police and crime panel, which is mostly made up of councillors in the force area, are now investigating Police Commissioner Sue Mount-Stevens for not pulling the chief constable up over the detectives who can't find any fraud despite this alleged evidence. We hear from one Lloyds Bank victim who used to advise the Home Office on property fraud, Trevor Mealham. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon this week on Tuesday. The post-Brexit crisis, Edward Horgan is a former major in the Irish Army turned to a plane spotter. He's documenting what he calls illegal troop flights, which use Shannon Airport as a stop-off point between the United States and the Middle East. Plus, yes, the post-Brexit crisis, I get grilled too. If we leave the EU on the 29th of March, could we face a double whammy of a Middle East war between Iran and Israel, as well as a euro-dollar collapse? You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk right now. But we start with going back to speak to Justin, and I do feel like I'm sort of ploughing my own furrow here on this Shamima Begum story. But one of the things I dug out, Justin, was that these three girls that were lured from Bethnal Green online onto a flight to Istanbul and then shepherded through Turkey down into Syria to join ISIS were actually taken there, according to the Turkish authorities, who arrested the guy that did it, allegedly, they were taken there by Canadian intelligence. And so, in other words, Canadian taxpayers were paying to groom London school children, 15 and 16 years old, online in order for them to join ISIS. Now, does this come as any surprise to you?
Well, you and I, Tony, we know that the whole war on terror is suspect. From the events of 9/11, which, you know, we can drive a coach and horses through the official narrative of 9/11. The real people behind the whole war on terror, everything that's happened in Syria, Iraq, Libya, everywhere you look, we can pretty well point to the same group or the mindset that we're up against. And I'm going to repeat myself. This is the mindset that also controls the world's money. We are talking about barely 1%. In fact, it's hardly that at all. We're talking about no more than 2,000 or 3,000 people in the world who have the power, because they control the money, they have the power to be able to literally create wars, terror, or anything they like to do through bogus agencies, intelligence agencies, who we think are working for us, but in fact, many cases, they're working for this tiny elite, this mindset that we're up against.
Now, hang on, though, because that surely here, what you've really got is a system by which, you know, you can, I mean, it, certainly yes, it could create wars and things like that, but surely the press would expose these people if they really existed.
If we really genuinely had a free press. I mean, the BBC at the moment, well, you're probably aware we have an organisation called UK Column, which has its own three times a week they put out an hour show, and they're taking apart what's going on. And if you listen to Vanessa Bealey, who was actually out in Syria, and, you know, her reports about the fact the White Helmets were actually terrorists. The White Helmets were not actually... they were not benevolent and helping people. They were absolutely, you know, working as part of the terror, the whole thing. Now, you know, take the Syrian president Assad himself. Is he the monster that people make him out to be? Well, again, Vanessa's met him, and other people have. And to me, he is not the monster, but the BBC will not have... They have an agenda, and as far as they're concerned... he is an appalling individual, and the whole Syrian government has to be overthrown, and they are backing effectively what are terrorists. I mean, the BBC cannot be believed as they used to be.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's also fascinating to see that just yesterday the Russians tweeted, and it wasn't just the Russians tweeting this, there are a lot of people who have been circulating this online or on social media. No mention of it whatsoever by the BBC, but a BBC producer has said the footage of the alleged gas attack victims in Syria, which sparked 57 cruise missile reprisal, was all staged. A Syria producer, Riam Dalab, has said on Twitter that the news footage of people being treated after the alleged chemical weapons attack in Douma was using actors.
Yeah, absolutely right. It is unravelling. Everything.
So why isn't that the main news of the day? I mean, surely that's absolutely scandalous, the idea that you're actually trying to start a war, effectively, using fake BBC footage.
Yeah, well, that's a very, very good question. And, again, you've got to look at the mindset, how they control all the mainstream media, the newspapers, everywhere you go. I personally... only watch the BBC now, the news, to see what they're not telling us and to actually try and see the picture. I mean, where do I start? There are just so many issues. I mean, they will not touch the Bradbury pound. They won't touch money creation and money supply. Everything that we're involved in at the British Constitution Group and the New Chartist movement, the great, you know, Magna Carta, you know, trying to restore our sovereign rights. We've written to the BBC. We've got nothing back whatsoever. They don't want to know.
Anyway, before we get off the subject of Shamima Begum, this young 15-year-old who was lured over to Turkey and then down into Syria, and who has just been interviewed, let's have a listen to what she had to say now, because it's, you know, it's sort of quite useful, I think, to hear exactly where she's coming from now. She's saying she wants to come back to the UK.
after my two kids died, now I'm really overprotective of this baby. I'm scared that this baby's going to get sick in this camp. That's why I really want to get back to Britain, because I know it will be taken care of, really. It came as a shock. It just came out of nowhere. It was so hard. So you have to remember that these people, their beliefs are that you cure the non-Muslim, but you treat the Muslims, you know, good.
You said you didn't regret coming to be part of the caliphate.
I don't regret it.
But on the other hand,
when I came and I saw that there's like underground oppression and all this happening, came with a shock to me, like this is actually happening.
Well, so in a way, she's saying she does regret it in a way, isn't she? So that's what she seems to be saying there. But also, I think we've just lost Justin on the line there. So that is pretty shocking, really, to see that. I think that there's so many aspects of this story. I did a report on it back in 2016. I did report on which went on to Redress Online. There's all sorts of aspects of this that I'm hoping to speak to Justin about just then, but he's now disappeared. I have to try and get him back. And while I'm doing that, let's have a listen to related story, which is slightly related, which is also about the BBC. This one is it was a report which was on the BBC World Service this week, and it's about a woman called Anastasia Shevchenko. Now, she has been arrested in Russia for running what is the Russian authorities say is a subversive campaign which is funded from abroad. Although the BBC don't really explain that, and they certainly don't mention the oligarch Khodorkovsky, who is based in Switzerland now. And he was in prison for 10 years in Russia for stealing massive amounts of state assets from the Yukos oil firm. And he is the backer of the Open Russia movement, which Anastasia Shevchenko was part of. So if there is some financial whiz kid from abroad who is financing an organisation which is trying to subvert the Russian government, I would have thought it was fairly normal that such a person should be, first of all, dissuaded from joining that, and then if they persist, then they would probably face some kind of sanction. Not necessarily arrest, but you can't have foreign governments paying for people to undermine your own government. And it's quite understandable in many ways that the Russians have done this. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the BBC report on this arrest of this woman and detention of this woman, Anastasia Shevchenko, who's part of the Open Russia movement, which they don't actually mention in the report at all, the name of the movement. And they certainly don't mention the fact that it's funded by Khodorkovsky from Switzerland.
Anastasia Shevchenko is facing up to 6 years in prison for her alleged links to an opposition group that's been banned in Russia as undesirable. The crimes of which it's accused include attending political debates and peaceful protests. Human rights groups have condemned the treatment of the activist. But public anger over her case has been growing too since the death of her daughter. Sarah Rainsford reports from Rostov in southern Russia.
These days, Anastasia Shevchenko is only allowed outside to go to court. That's where I found her, with a police escort just one step behind.
How are you feeling, Matthew?
I can't talk.
The ban on speaking is a condition of her house arrest. There is a good reason this Russian single mum looks tense. She's now facing 6 years in prison for her political activism. The hearing was Anastasia's appeal for release ahead of her trial. She's been charged with links to an opposition group based in Britain and outlawed here in Russia as undesirable. Right from the start, her case has been condemned by human rights groups as draconian. Then, 2 weeks ago, Anastasia's eldest daughter was taken seriously ill. She was only allowed to visit Alina in hospital hours before she died. So this was how she addressed her accuser.
I would ask Mr. Prosecutor not to display pointless cruelty to my family. You could have let me see my daughter and hug her. If I'd made it to the hospital a day earlier, I'd have been able to do that.
Anastasia's plight has struck a chord with many Russian women. Last weekend in Moscow, hundreds turned out in protest. They called this the March of Mother's Fury. Some carried stuffed toys in place of placards.
So there's the BBC's report there. No mention whatsoever of the Open Russia movement being funded by Mikhail Khodorkovsky. This does seem... Are you back there now, Justin?
Yeah, sorry, we seem to have got cut off.
That's OK.
I didn't hear most of that, I'm afraid.
OK, anyway, the point being that in... This just to cover this particular story is that the BBC are reporting the arrest, and there's a campaign going on in Russia of Anastasia Shevchenko. She's part of something called the Open Russia Movement, and the BBC didn't actually say she was part of the Open Russia Movement, although I think they do on the internet version, and they certainly don't mention that this is being funded by Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who of course is a billionaire who's now based in Switzerland, who made most of his money as a Russian oligarch through getting hold of the Yukos oil firm for something like 2 or 3% of its real value. So what do you... I mean, this is just one example, but what do you make of the BBC and other media's anti-Russian propaganda?
Well, I'm keeping an open mind on what's happening in Russia at the moment, because I'm hearing rumours that Putin is considering declaring war on his central bank, which is obviously is part of the Bank for International Settlements, and he may do what John F. Kennedy did with his executive order 11110, when it got the Treasury, the U.S. Treasury, to create basically dollars based on their silver gilt stocks. And many believe that that was probably a good reason why he was assassinated, because he was going against the Federal Reserve and the central banking system. Now, if Putin does this, and I've been told it could be gold-backed or it could be silver-backed, and he starts to create a treasury ruble rather than being involved too much with the central banking system, that could be very interesting indeed.
Well, it's already very interesting, I think, because a lot of people around the world are starting to invest in Russia because they don't have this whole thing of zero interest rates, which most of the Western world has, and in fact in Switzerland even negative interest rates. So you put £1,000 in the bank, you will find there's only 990 left, or 900 left the next year, because you've got... don't get any interest in the banks anymore in Switzerland. And in Russia, they're running apparently round about something like 7 or 8% interest. So a lot of people are actually putting their money into Russian banks in the knowledge that there'll be a real return.
Yeah, well, at the moment, as I said, I'm keeping my options open as regards Russia. I mean, Putin doesn't strike me as a real democrat. I mean, he probably is an oligarch. But on the other hand, what is the alternative? And you mentioned that gentleman living in Switzerland, and I hardly view him as a benevolent alternative. So, and the Russian people, certainly when you look at Russia today compared to what Russia was like 30 years ago, I would say they're in a pretty good place at the moment. And they're full of self-confidence. And... I'm keeping an open mind on that. But going back to the BBC, we basically in the New Chartists, we're going to be starting a campaign probably in April and May, where we're going to have peaceful vigils outside the BBC in London and Manchester, and asking them for live televised debates so that their journalists, the BBC journalists, can debate with what we term the alternative media journalists. And let's discuss things like health issues, 9/11, money creation, all these issues where we know we are at odds with what the BBC are saying. So, you know, part of our charter surely is to get to the truth on things. So let's have a proper, open, you know, basically live debates on these issues where their journalists can put their point of view and debate with basically our journalists, like yourself, Tony, and people, you know, working the UK column and New Chartists, whoever. But the point is, bring these issues and let's see where the truth lies.
Well, look, before we get completely away from talking about Shamima Begum and the general war on terror, and particularly what's been going on with the Russians moving into Syria, I mean, there seems to be an attempt by the Americans to sort of claim that they have beaten ISIS, where I think most people are aware that it's actually the Syrian army and the Russians that have done that, not the Americans, is looking at this whole aspect. I mean, it's been this kind of, I would say, characterised as a kind of moral panic right across the media over the last day or so about should this woman be allowed to come back to Britain. Well, as far as I can see, she wasn't actually a fighter for Islamic State over in Syria. She was basically there to befriend the men who were the fighters and to be kind of a support worker of some kind. However you want to take that. The question is, should she be allowed back to come back to Britain? There's kind of lots of people getting very frenetic saying no, she shouldn't. And there was a bit of a discussion on BBC's Question Time about that last night. But the question really is, I mean, if she was taken over there, as it looks as if the Turkish evidence certainly says, by the Canadian intelligence, the other question here is that there are actually lots and lots of people since the demise of ISIS after the Russians arrived in Syria. Lots and lots of Brits have come back, and there's a fascinating Daily Mirror article, Justin, saying that only 14 out of 400 British ISIS fighters who've returned to the UK after fighting in Syria have actually been interviewed and jailed. Most of them have just been allowed to sort of just come back. So why is it that suddenly one woman has hit the headlines for a whole day? Everyone seems to be talking about, oh, she shouldn't be allowed back. Well, there are so many that have been allowed back and apparently just been allowed to go back into normal society.
Well, you're absolutely right, Tony. Personally, I err on the side of compassion in the case of this lady, and I think she should be brought back to her family, and she's got to be deprogrammed and she's got to be helped. So that's my basic thing. But when we talk about ISIS, what was ISIS, who created it, who created Al-Qaeda, who created the Mujahideen, again, because we know we have this mindset in the world that does not hold our best interests at heart and are basically seeking what can only be described as a global future of basically like a feudal system of enslavement for all of us, as I said, because they control the money, they control all aspects of the governance, and in fact they're trying to get about some sort of, we've got Agenda 2130, which is at the UN. This is about putting people into smart cities and all sorts of stuff.
Well, look, let me just drag you back, I'm afraid, to talk about these returning fighters from Syria. This is an article from the 9th of October 2016, Stephen Jones, assistant editor at the Daily Mirror. Only 14 of 400 British ISIS fighters who returned to the UK after fighting in Syria have been jailed, he says. The shock figure was admitted by the government is much lower than the ministers had previously claimed. So it means that almost 400 jihadis trained in Syria and Iraq are at large on Britain's streets. And that was reported in turn by the Mail on Sunday back in 2016. But there's also another article from the Telegraph. More than 425 of the 850 Britons who left to join Islamic State the last 5 years have returned. Only fewer in Turkey's 900 returnees, Tunisia's 800. So what they're saying in the Telegraph is more British ISIL fighters have returned home than to any other Western country. And that was being reported in 2017, a year after the previous article. So we seem to have a lot of these people running around who have probably had contact with British intelligence of one sort or another. Certainly they know who they are. What's bothering me most about this, Justin, is that these people will obviously be a bit nervous that they may be arrested, they may be jailed, and so they make perfect recruits for intelligence services to do dirty tricks of various sorts.
Well, I am very worried indeed. We've got the rise of Tommy Robinson, who is clearly states he's a Zionist and everything else. You've got the far right getting animated about the Muslim problem and all this stuff. And I fear, what I fear most is violence and unrest and chaos on the streets, and because this gives the elite the absolute excuse to bring in Orwellian control over all of us, and we can kiss goodbye to those things we hold so dear, the Great Charter, habeas corpus, trial by jury, all this. Because we're already seeing trial by jury is taking second place now. We're getting more and more judges overseeing the courts with no juries.
Well, let me just also intervene again. Sorry to keep interrupting you, but I mean, looking at these, most of these terrorist cases, particularly the 7/7 London bombings case, this was done, it wasn't a public inquiry, it should have been a public inquiry. It was done as a series of inquests, as if these deaths had all been independent, the 52 or so people who died that day. And also, they made sure that there was no jury there as well. They dismissed there was no jury at all.
It is very worrying, Tony. I mean, this is the real reason why we're involved as New Chartists. We're trying to keep what is rightfully ours. We are all sovereign human beings, and we are entitled to a trial by jury, common law constitution. That is, we are a common law country. But as all part of this European integration, we are losing our most basic...
Well, look, anyway, you mentioned Tommy Robinson there very appositely, because this week there's some fascinating footage released of Tommy Robinson doing some kind of selfie, looking as if he was high on something, maybe beginning with the letter C. I'm not entirely sure, but it certainly looked like that. And so let's have a little listen to a clip now. This is Tommy Robinson ranting away as he talks about how easy it is for him to score drugs and how he would seize the whole conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis rather like the conflict between Rangers and Celtic in Glasgow, and he explains who he would fight for. So let's have a listen to Tommy Robinson now.
Move over, because me coming through, and this is what me and we're going to do. I'm going to punch you in the head, I'll kick you in the face, because I am the king of the whole Islam race! No matter where I've gone in the world, I score. I'll show you tonight. As soon as we get in this pub, I'm going to record it for you. I've gone to Qatar, pub. I've gone to Doha, the school gear on the sesh while they're all praying. I've gone everywhere, mate, everywhere. Every city I've gone to. When we went to Germany for the World Cup, I was like, see you later, lads. Where are you going? I'm going to find out. And then that's it, we're on.
So I had to ring Benjamin Netem Black Palestine, I can't remember his name. And then I got my Zionist card out, which said, I am a Zionist. And then I bought everything. Shalom, Harry, listen, let me tell you something. Yeah? If there was a war tomorrow, which there will be, because I'll probably start at the end of the session, if there was a war and it kicked off, I would be there on the front line fighting for Israel. Do you know why? Why not? Why not? It's like Celtic, as I'm when I make dad's part to me earlier talking about Celtic, like, oh yeah, but yeah, Celtic Rangers, f*** off, you know what I mean? Palestine, f*** Palestine. Look, why would you support Palestine?
Well, that's Tommy Robinson there characterising the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis in the occupied territories as a game of football between Glasgow, Celtic and Rangers.
Yeah. Yeah. As I said, I worry about Tommy Robinson, or that's not even his real name. I think he's a Pied Piper. I think he's leading a lot of people astray. This whole Zionist business, I just feel, I mean, look what's happening in the Labour Party at the moment, because as soon as you start to question Israel, Zionism, and what they're up to, and you don't, you know, as I said, I always say to people, feed into any search engine Jews against Zionism or Jews against Israel. I'm working with Jewish people who are concerned about Zionism, who are concerned about Israel. And I just find it very alarming that all our political parties have friends of Israel, friends of, you know, we don't have friends of Russia in groups and friends of France or friends of Japan. But friends of Israel, that's allowed. And it doesn't matter if it's UKIP, Lib Dems, Conservative, Labour, they've all got their friends of Israel. Well, I'm sorry, you know, my RMPs should be serving our country. They should be serving our interests. And they should be working to make this world a safer, peaceful and environment, you know, restore and protect the environment of the world. That's what our MPs should be doing, not taking sides of just one country. So I just wonder what on earth is going on with all this anti-Semitic stuff, because, you know, as soon as you start to question what Israel are up to, you're accused of being anti-Semitic. Well, I'm sorry, in which case I'm anti-Semitic. I just find it incredible, Tony.
What do you think's behind it, then?
Well, I'm going to go back to that mindset that we know doesn't like the human race. Now, in our research over the last 6 months, we've had some very, very good, well-researched people tell us to look up the Sabbatean Frankists. That's S-A-B-B-A-T-E-A-N, Sabbatean, and then Frankist. Look them up, because these were a sect in the 17th century in Turkey, and they've infiltrated effectively the Catholic Church with the Jesuits, and they've infiltrated Islam, and they've infiltrated Judaism. Now, as I said, we're still on a steep learning curve with this, but we're starting to see this bloodline mindset, which really is creating, if you like, virtually all the problems that humanity is up against.
I think it's fair to say, isn't it, that there's actually only really a tiny number of people who have been, you know, throughout history creating a mess for everybody else, that, you know, with these people out of the way and honest people in charge, actually humanity could actually start to flourish, Justin.
Let me just give you a quick example, In 1999, I was a government guest to Iran. I went out to the state of Iran. And, of course, I went there with some trepidation because I thought, my God, this is a country which is, you know, creating wars. They've just had their war against Iraq and, you know, all the rest of it. And I was worried because I believed the BBC in those days. When I got there, I was received by ordinary people in the street. I had a minder. I had a government minder. She was an 18-year-old girl student who just wanted to know all about Britain, what it was like to live in Britain, etc. I met the president, Khatami, and the vice president. We even had a fish and chip supper at the English club in Tehran. You couldn't make this stuff up. And it was absolutely wonderful. And I was taken to ordinary people. I was taken out to families. And it was just a lovely country. Totally different to what we were led to believe. So I genuinely do believe that if we can just expose and take down this mindset who controls the world's money, who effectively are trying to create superstates. This is what this European superstate is all about. We don't want a superstate. We just want countries, sovereign countries, working together peacefully, in harmony, and most importantly, all protecting the environment of our planet. So we can hand over to...
But surely the EU is just there for people to facilitate trade and business.
I wish that was just the case. If we went back to the original common market before it morphed into this superstate, you do know our armed services are being effectively handed over to Europe. I mean, the UK column and others are heading the charge on this to try and wake people up to the fact that our armed services will be beholden to the European Union at the end of this year.
Well, hopefully not after the 29th of March. Anyhow, look, I mean, you mentioned Iran there. Very little coverage of it, but there was a horrific attack in Iran this week. Iran's President Rouhani vows punishment for the Sistan-Baluchistan attack. 3 days of mourning are declared to honour 27 dead Revolutionary Guard members as Iran links the deadly attack to US action. Earlier, the Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said it is no coincidence that his country was hit on the same day that the US held a summit in Poland, which is seen as aimed at countering Iran.
Yeah. Well, I'm not obviously an expert on that, exactly what's going on, but I would say that qui bono, who benefits? Always ask that question. Always question everything. Qui bono, who benefits from something that happens?
Well, also, it's worth remembering that this week is the 40th anniversary of the 1979 Iranian Revolution. So this meeting in Poland is scheduled to coincide with that. The idea is to try and get regime change in Iran, but also, of course, at the same time, an attack on the Revolutionary Guard. I mean, it would really be like exploding a bomb in Horse Guards Parade and killing 27 or 30 guardsmen. Or whatever, who were guarding the White Hall.
Yeah, I know. As I said, we've got intelligence services out of control. And within those intelligence services, I think there's a degree of, there are elements, probably the majority, who are genuine patriots who think they believe they're serving their country and they believe they're doing what's right. But there is a minority who are very much there, basically receiving their instructions from the deep state.
And if anyone steps out of line, like Dr. David Kelly did in the run-up to the 2003 illegal Iraq war, the idea, I suppose, is that it's very clear what will happen to them. Also this week, Justin, let's just run through some international news stories. We'll stick with the Middle East, I suppose. Benjamin Netanyahu has fired back at Iran. I mean, I don't know if that's literally, but anyway, he says, attack Tel Aviv and it will be the last anniversary you ever celebrate. At a rally celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, a senior Iranian commander threatened to raise Tel Aviv to the ground if the US attacks them. So they're making it very clear in Iran, if the US attacks Iran, that they will hit Tel Aviv.
Yeah, as I said, the Middle East politics, I simply say, you know that Israel is wanting the Greater Israel Project, that it exists. We know that there's something to do with the temple, the mount. I'm not a great expert on this.
But they want to create the third temple, don't they?
Yeah.
On the Temple Mount. The only thing, of course, here, there could be some kind of compromise between the Israeli government or between the Third Temple group, as they're called, that want to create this temple on Temple Mount. They've got this massive problem in that the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is one of the oldest and the most revered mosques in the whole of Islam, is right smack bang in the middle of Temple Mount. So if they want to rebuild the Third Temple, they'll have to knock down that mosque. But there could be some kind of compromise, because there is another mosque there called the Dome of the Rock, which is on the side, which wouldn't have to be demolished. So I just, thing is, Justin, I can't see the Iranians and the Israelis, I can't really see Islamic representatives and Zionist representatives getting together on this, demolition of something like the Al-Aqsa Mosque could spark a religious war.
No, I know. And the controllers, who are the real controllers in the world, know damn well what they're doing. I just want religion is a wonderful thing for some people. But on the other hand, there's so much poison in the religion, it can start wars.
Well, that's what you're also suggesting there, is that these major faiths have also got these kind of parasitic organisations on the side of them.
Yeah, this is exactly what's happened. And, you know, the faiths, I mean, I once experienced, it was back in the 1970s now, I was in Assisi, and all the faiths are represented to discuss the environment and discuss protection of the environment. This is the early days when Jacques Cousteau was talking about it, and it was a wonderful experience. You had Muslims, you had Hindus, you had Buddhists, you had Christians, you had everyone. Total harmony. So something is wrong with the religions, and it has to be this Sabbatean Frankis. We have got this satanic, evil side to the religions that have somehow latched themselves on. And I think people who need to do their research, they need to really start asking questions about this. We are, as I said, we the research has only just begun on this to really try and find out what on earth is going on.
Well, let me just suggest something. Maybe the nihilists are getting involved, because these people will say anything and do anything to get what they want, including putting on the vestments of a Catholic cardinal or an archbishop of the Church of England or anything, and they absolutely have no morals whatsoever.
Yeah, and the other thing we haven't really, I touched upon it with Ted Heath, but the other thing, I'm part of a thing called the International Tribunal of Natural Justice, and we had a hearing in London last year, and you can see them. If you go on ITNJ and just feed in ITNJ hearing on child trafficking, you will realise that millions of children are suffering appalling acts, ranging from murder right through to obviously paedophilia and everything else, and outright slavery. This is the thing that really has motivated me now, that we've really got to get things
moving. Well, one of the big flashpoints around the world, of course, is between India and Pakistan, both nuclear-armed powers. Yeah. And just yesterday we saw a horrific attack there in Kashmir. 44 Indian soldiers were killed. Now, obviously, the Indians, immediately the knee-jerk reaction is to point the finger at Pakistan, which they've done. But that isn't necessarily the case, Justin, is it? There are also these kind of third actors. I mean, we've seen this in, you know, the Ian Fleming's novels, where there are other actors that just simply want to get countries fighting each other, and then they can actually make a profit out of it.
And of course, as I say, bankers make huge profits out of wars. I mean, it's like, as we both know, because we both studied the First World War and the Second World War, the real history to the First and Second World War is yet to be told. How it came about, who funded it, who really engineered. I mean, the First World War, we all believe it was, you know, the sort of inbred relations of Victoria all falling out, and you had generals wanting to try out their new weaponry and everything else. No, the bankers were manoeuvring around the place. They were creating the problems. And just as you look with how the, as we mentioned, the Weimar Republic collapsing, but then look how Hitler suddenly managed to come onto the scenes. Who funded him? And interesting, of course, that Hitler actually did use a form of Bradbury to suddenly start building autobahns.
Well, I'll tell you who funded Hitler. That was the Bank for International Settlements. That was certainly one of them, you mentioned earlier, who the idea was to close them down at the Bretton Woods conference. But look, there's another story popped up this week. We'll try and rattle through them here on this show, Justin, and that is that Australia's Prime Minister's advisor says climate change is a UN-led ruse to establish a new world order. Tony Abbott's business advisor says global warming is a fallacy, supported by the UN in order to create a new authoritarian world order under its control.
Right, well, I'm just going to have to give you a personal example of how I know that he's right. I mean, you know, as I say, I'm a green. I'm passionate about protecting the environment, the ecosystems and everything else. But because of my uncle, I met a chap called Aurelio Peche, who was the co-founder of the Club of Rome. And I had lunch with him and Thor Heyerdahl, the explorer. In fact, he actually offered me a job to come and work for him as one of his personal advisors. And he actually said, we are creating a global problem that will force people to accept global government. And that global problem that they were creating was man-made global warming, not climate change. Climate change has been going on for millions of years. But man-made global warming, this is the science that they were developing. Now, Piers Corbyn, Jeremy Corbyn's brother, he absolutely knows that it's bad science. I was privileged enough to know David Bellamy, and I can remember having a cup of coffee, and he just looked at me and said, Justin, this is all bad science, bad science.
Hang on, what's this? Doesn't sound like the BBC.
Outside the box is in. Virtue signalling and confirmation bias is out. In depth on dialect. Bristol's first podcast here on BCFM every Wednesday at noon. Well, I can just ask listeners if they would like to go back to one of the dialect programmes from a couple of months ago, where we had Joe House, who's the climate science lead, Dr. Joe House, up at Bristol University, having an hour, a ding-dong, with Piers Corbyn. And I'll just leave it. I'll put a link up to that show on our show page and see who you think did the best. Also, look, must talk a little bit more, I'm afraid, about European affairs, because we've had this week, Justin, we've had the Catalonian MPs put on trial for sedition and for rebellion. At the same time, the Spanish government have found that they cannot get their budget through, and so they're going to have to call a general election in Spain.
Yeah, now the Catalonian thing, obviously the country is split on this. I'm actually a great fan of Leopold Kerr, the writings of Leopold Kerr, and he actually wrote a book called The Breakdown of Nations, where he said basically the smaller the sovereign nations, all working in harmony, you don't have major problems, you don't have major wars. I can sympathise with the people of Catalonia, but the thing is this, the trial that those people accused of rebellion are now having to sit through is a kangaroo court. This is not a trial of randomly selected people to hear the argument in court and for the jury to be the judge to make the decision whether they are guilty or not. They are having to sit before an appointed panel of judges, politically appointed judges. And this is typical of Roman civil law, which is prevalent in Europe and which is creeping into our country. So I feel, you know, I feel a sort of empathy with the people of Catalonia. If they genuinely want, if there's a sizable majority, two-thirds majority is the safe number you should go for if you're making major constitutional changes. But I do actually feel sorry for the people of Catalonia at the moment with what's going on. And I think the Spanish government, well, they've got to realise that if they show compassion and they try and meet, they may be able to defuse the situation. But
they're not doing that, basically. They're going for a general election instead. So we'll see what happens there. Also on Italy, Guy Verhofstadt tweeted this week. He said, I love Italy. It's the place where our European civilization was born. From being a staunch defender of Europe, it's now the country that is under pressure from Putin to prevent the European Union from being united against Maduro. It's very painful for me to see such political degeneration. Well, this is interesting in that he's saying that the Italians are the only people in Europe who are supporting Maduro over in Venezuela, and everyone else is united that this new right-wing guy that the Americans support should be running the country.
Yeah, and I would simply say sovereign national credit. Maduro could be creating debt-free, interest-free money for his people. I was actually quite an admirer of his predecessor. You know, I felt
Hugo Chavez.
Yeah, Hugo Chavez. And I was very sorry when he died because I think he was genuinely a good man.
But what about this whole thing of accusing the Italians of kowtowing to Putin?
Yes, I mean, it's a joke. I mean, at least we have a government in Italy now which is not your straightforward left-right spectrum. You've got people who appear to be applying common sense and applying a rationale to what they're doing and saying. And if they can clearly see that what's happening in Venezuela is not right. And they've spoken out. So they've broken ranks, if you like, with the rest of the countries, which are all in line with the thinking of the 1%. So, yeah, I just say, as I said, Venezuela, I just hope to God it doesn't become a Vietnam.
It's also in South America. There's also Argentina to look at this week. In Al Jazeera reporting, tens of thousands have been marching against austerity in Argentina. Many Argentines, already struggling with inflation, have been hit harder as Macri cuts government spending. Basically, he's just been told what to do by the IMF.
Yeah, well, exactly. And the IMF is a public front to the people, BIS. As I said, everything is, a government is not really a sovereign government over its people. And whilst you have this money creation and money supply system that is totally 100% corrupt and needs to go lock, stock and barrel, if you keep with that system, then your government will be controlled by the BIS and the people who control the BIS. Because the BIS is just a holding camp. I mean, basically, the governors of the top central banks go there to receive their instructions.
Well, Mark Carney, of course, is famously from there. He's from their policy committee and regulation committee that deregulated so much that we had a 2008 financial crisis.
Yeah. And as I said, there's a reset plan. We know that there's something being lined up for a collapse, where they can reset the... Because what they're trying to do is go for what we call a global electronic monetary system. They're trying to take cash out of the system. They're trying to make us into a cashless society, closing down high street banks and everything else. So the whole thing becomes banking and becomes digital. With all the Bitcoin and all these different weird and wonderful currencies, you'll find the central banking people now. I don't understand it. I'm going to be the first one to admit it's all beyond me. But blockchains and various other things. I'm told that there may be a way of creating a sort of Bradbury-type electronic system, which would be...
Well, that's just real speculation there. Anyway, let's wind up by having a listen to Ian Neal, who died last week. He's somebody I know you knew, Justin, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I'm very sorry to hear that.
So let's have a listen to what Ian said. And I asked him, first of all, about some of the... I mean, he was one of the original 9/11 truth campaigners back in just not long after the 2001 attacks. And he was himself as an engineer. He's worked in all sorts of third world countries, etc. So I was fascinated to hear, really, what he had to say about some of the major figures around the world who've come out and as not a 9/11 truthers, saying we're not being told the truth about what really happened in the September the 11th attacks and demanding a proper investigation by the media too.
Well, first of all, it's normally ignored, but the story dies a death. But we need more of those, and we need the different campaigns who are calling for transparency and accountability in this country to come together and not be afraid to be... Well, yes, we are saying it's a conspiracy. We can't tell you exactly how it happened, so we don't necessarily have our own theory of the actual mechanics. You know, we also know, of course, that the media is intensely infiltrated by the intelligence services. And I do like that approach of trying to find people within the mainstream that come out and challenge things. So there's people like Ed Asner, the famous US actor, was very supportive of the 9/11 families and critical to that. Some of the family members like William Rodriguez have been over to this country and spoken, and his testimony is very powerful because there's an eyewitness there to the events of the day, and the official version cannot be true given what he experienced and his witness. So the other sort of little, Michael Meacher.
He's a Labour MP, I think, actually, up until fairly recently, well, one of the longest-serving Labour cabinet ministers.
Yes, he was, yeah. But what happened as a result of that? Nobody responded to say, Michael...
What did Michael actually say?
He didn't... He basically said, I have my doubts about the... And then he lists all the elements of the official version, which he was struggling with. And if you go into the details of the intelligence and the defence failures and the nature of the tower collapses and so forth, you know, I share those questions. But the issue is that here's a UK MP...
He's also a member of the Shadow Cabinet. Yes. He's a former cabinet minister.
Highly respected.
Privy Councillor.
Yeah. But did anyone respond to his questions? No. In the media, amongst his colleagues and so forth. And maybe based on his experience back in... and I hesitate on the dates, but I'm pretty sure it's around 2008, about 10 years ago. 10 of us spent an hour in the House of Commons with Jeremy Corbyn going through all the evidence and case for that. Listened politely and acknowledged there were serious questions to answer and was supportive, but that didn't translate into action. It didn't translate into public statements. So, and there have been vague other statements which are supportive of 9/11 truth, but at the same time hasn't been carried forward into wider recognition. An example would be John Pilger, where he has voiced questions but hasn't taken his arguments further, and he doesn't make it in a high profile event. So you know, every time somebody comes out who's high profile, and it helps to spread the word, it helps to interest people, but equally it does tell you how fearful people are to step out of line with the elite. They especially in the media, they recognize the consequences of it.
What are the consequences?
Well, you won't work again, I think. It's probably, you will just quietly get dropped. Or you won't get a belt crest. That would be my... We've so frequently approached broadcasters, newspapers, for the right of reply. Case in point was the BBC's conspiracy files. Completely didn't engage with us at all, just put out their message of...
I mean, they did a programme, was it about 9/11, or was it one that went specifically about Building 7, I think they did?
Actually, four, as I believe. So there was the overview of 9/11, then there was the tower collapses, and related to that, they even did a particular programme trying to explain, but I still can't get my head around, how they managed to broadcast the fact that... the World Trade Center 7, the third tower to collapse on 9/11, a fact that I would wager the majority of the population of this country would still be unaware of, i.e. that the three towers collapsed rather than two towers collapsed on 9/11, because it's hardly ever been broadcast since. So anyway, the programme they did was trying to explain how Jane Stanley could manage to broadcast the fact that this building had collapsed 10 minutes before it actually did collapse. In other words, somebody had given them prior warning that this building was going to collapse.
Well, there was even a picture of the building still standing behind her as she announced it. This does suggest, doesn't it, that you've got...
Funnily enough, Tony, guess what happened when she was doing that? Oh, we just lost the satellite feed there, Tony. Oh, we'll be back to you in a second. Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, whatever. Yeah,
so it does suggest that some of these events, the news people aren't really news people. They're more like theatrics following a script.
Yeah, stenographers and... okay, I suppose... And we should reflect on how the media's become more controlled just since 9/11. I can... remember times when the BBC wasn't always as controlled as it now is. At least they would broadcast things that you won't see the light of day of now. But yes, it's remarkable. If people are interested on trying to look at the wider picture, I would recommend a website that's called wanttoknow.info. Just put want to know in. The reason I like this website is that it's got various sectors that it looks at, providing evidence that this conspiracy, the New World Order, if you like, or the global elite, infiltrates all these different areas, the military, the media, health, so many different aspects, money creation and supply. Right, but the reason why this website is of interest is the evidence they use is all drawn from mainstream media sources. So you can check out... This is mainstream broadcasters basically saying, yes, there is. Oh, child abuse was the other one. Some fantastic documentaries on there. But the point I'm just trying to, you know, that site is a very good starting point because you wouldn't be shy of showing that to your relatives and so forth.
It seems to me that what you're saying is that the mainstream media is telling us the truth. It's just that it hasn't got the bigger picture.
Yeah. And... As PNAC shows, the various deliberations we've had about New World Order and so forth, hey, they tell us what they're doing themselves. You know, they tell us their plans. It's just nobody takes any interest.
The X-Files, the truth is out there.
Yes, indeed so.
Why do you think that you have still been working? I mean, this is, well, we're talking about 15 years after the beginning of the UK 9/11 truth campaign. Why do you think you're still at it?
I guess the thing which is brings me back to it is recognising the connection between 9/11 and events that are happening today. And so, well, let's just take the last year. So you've got the child abuse inquiry and all the questions around that. And then you've got the war in Syria and the... You know, we're going to war now, not on, fanciful presentations to the UN, but on YouTube videos. You know, and then we don't even bother going any further in terms of proof. We just drop some bombs. We go and drop some cruise missiles on a chemical weapons factory. Go figure that one. You know, we're trying to blow up an alleged chemical weapons factory. So that, you know, that should be making everybody scream, what the heck is going on here? Same with Duma, given the evidence which has come out about that, which discredits the White Helmet's testimony from Robert Fisk and from other independent reporters on the ground and people who witnessed it, that there were no chemical weapons used. But I am seeing these connections all the time between... the wars of today and the cover-ups of today and with 9/11. So I guess why I latch on to 9/11 is because its consequences are still reverberating with us today. And the body of evidence... OK, I've just mentioned Duma, and there's probably two or three reports or angles on the evidence which calls the official version into account. On 9/11, there must be 100 different aspects or angles, probably 500, you know? Each of them backed up with solid testimony and solid evidence that just cannot be explained away. I'll give you one brief example. In relation to World Trade Center 7, first of all, most people aren't aware of it, but how do we explain away the testimony of Barry Jennings? Maybe you're not familiar with him, but look him up. Okay. Sadly, he died 2 days before the NIST report, which was the official report into its collapse, many years in the making because it was so difficult to explain. He died 2 days before their inquiry came out. But his testimony was that he personally witnessed explosions within World Trade Center 7 before it collapsed. The other question marks relate to the nature of the iron spheres, which indicate explosives were used in its collapse. Related to that, how do we possibly explain fire-induced collapse the heat signature in the foundations of the towers, which were far in excess of the temperatures required to melt steel, far in excess of the temperatures reached in normal office fires?
So there's Ian Neal there speaking to me last June. Died last week, unfortunately, of brain tumour. Justin, you worked with him, I believe.
Yes. I'm very sad to hear that, because Ian, when we started the 9/11 truth movement in this country, he was the one who talked to me first, got me on board. And then when Ian Crane stood down as chair, I think Ian, myself and Annie Masham became co-chairs, and we carried on for a few more years before we handed the baton over to somebody else. I'm very sad. He was a nice chap, and as you heard there, he was summing up pretty well what tonight's program's been about. I'm very sorry to hear about his death. Very sad.
Also, another person that died this week is Lyndon LaRouche. Let's have a listen to him. He's a much more controversial figure. He believed that the British were some kind of incredibly evil force that were trying to control the world. So let's have a clip of him now saying some of his controversial things about us.
The British Empire has always been, since its beginning, as a beginning, has been a satanic operation. It has been intrinsically satanic. And what's happened is the effect of that kind of culture and the fact that people try to get by satisfying the demands of that culture, that is the way in which many people in the United States have lost their souls.
Well, that's Lyndon LaRouche, who died this week. And also, you heard just before that from Ian Neal. Anyway, thank you very much, Justin Walker. Also, thanks to Mike Davis and to Clive Stevens, councillors. Tonight, time to sign off for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show...
So the railroad workers were very familiar with how to run a train, and they would just go into a train yard and grab an engine, hook it up, and take off.
Who's going to stop them, right?
Yeah. Well, the government then would get a train and go chasing after them. They had a few shootouts. They had... when they got stuck, then they would start walking if they had to. Some of them... hired boats and took boats down the Mississippi and then up the Ohio River. It got a lot of press coverage. It was a very colorful episode, the whole Coxey movement, which was taking place March, April, and May of 1894.
In 1894, President Grover Cleveland worried about a national insurrection as the country grappled with a deep depression. We'll talk about this time and also the historic Pullman strike with Jack Kelly. Jack Kelly is the author of the book, The Edge of Anarchy, The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America. That's next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. President Trump says he's not happy with the border deal congressional negotiators hammered out last night, but he said another shutdown looks unlikely. The deal would fund the government through the rest of the fiscal year, September 30th, and avert another partial government shutdown, which otherwise looms after spending authority runs out Friday night. Negotiators reportedly agreed to $1.4 billion for 55 new miles of barriers along the border. That's far less than the $5.7 billion for an expanded border wall that President Trump repeatedly demanded. Still, Senate Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell claimed the deal as a victory.
It had been clear to everyone that in order to reach an agreement, our Democratic colleagues would have to walk away from two extreme positions that had been dictated to them, presumably by the far left. The notion that Congress shouldn't spend more than $1 on new border barriers, and the idea that we should impose a hard statutory cap on ICE detainees in the interior of our country, which would require the release of criminals into the United States. Fortunately, our Democratic colleagues did abandon those unreasonable positions, and the negotiations were able to move forward productively.
No details were immediately available on how negotiators resolved a key Democratic demand to cap the number of undocumented immigrants held by Immigration and Customs Enforcement in the interior of the country. Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer urged Trump to accept the deal. He recalled how Trump triggered a shutdown last December after he rejected a deal the Senate had approved on a voice vote.
We must not have a rerun of what happened a few months back, where legislators, Democrat and Republican, House and Senate agreed, and President Trump pulled the rug out from under the agreement and caused a shutdown. If he opposes this agreement, the same thing could happen again. We don't need it. So I strongly urge the president to sign this agreement. No one gets everything they want in these agreements. The president must sign it and not cause another shutdown.
Trump spoke at a rally in El Paso, Texas last night about the emerging deal.
I have to tell you, as I was walking up to the stage, they said that progress is being made with this committee. Just so you know, we're building the wall anyway.
Nearby, former El Paso Congressman Beto O'Rourke, a possible candidate for the White House in 2020, told those at a counter rally that El Paso is a safe community, not because of walls, but in spite of them.
Let's make sure that we refer to our human beings, our fellow human beings, with kindness, with respect, with dignity. Let's not be afraid of our own shadow or of who we are. Let's own this moment and the future and show the country there is nothing to be afraid of when it comes to the U.S.-Mexico border.
Beto O'Rourke. Mexico's most notorious drug kingpin, Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, was convicted on all counts of running an industrial-scale smuggling operation. The three-month trial featured tales of grisly killings, political payoffs, cocaine hidden in jalapeno cans, jewel-encrusted guns, and a naked escape with his lover through a tunnel. The 61-year-old could spend the rest of his life in a maximum security U.S. prison. New York jurors, whose identities were kept secret, reached a verdict after deliberating 6 days, sorting through what authorities called an avalanche of evidence gathered since the late 1980s that Guzman and his Sinaloa drug cartel made billions in profits by smuggling tons of cocaine, heroin, meth, and marijuana into the U.S. Evidence showed drugs poured into the country through secret tunnels or hidden in tanker trucks, concealed in the undercarriage of passenger cars, and packed in rail cars passing through legitimate points of entry. All that suggesting that a border wall would not make much of a difference in the still lucrative drug smuggling business. California Governor Gavin Newsom delivers his first State of the State address. It's sure to receive extra national attention after Newsom signed an executive order withdrawing most of California's National Guard troops from the border. Newsom said he would not participate in what he called the Trump administration's absurd theatrics.
I think this whole border issue is manufactured. The crisis on the border is a manufactured crisis. And we are not interested in participating in this political theater. I think it's nothing more than political theater.
Major General David Baldwin of the California National Guard said the troops have not participated in detaining immigrants, but some are conducting camera surveillance that could inadvertently lead to the apprehension of undocumented immigrants.
Any
intrusion across the border in between the ports of entry is illegal, even if you're a U.S. citizen. So our soldiers would report that to the Border Patrol for the Border Patrol to take action.
The California Latino Legislative Caucus welcomed the governor's action, saying lawmakers had been deeply concerned that the potential existed for the use of state resources to support a federal policy that has inflicted inhuman trauma on people seeking refuge in accordance with national and international laws. Republican Senator Rand Paul says he will oppose President Trump's nomination of William Barr as Attorney General. The full Senate is expected to vote on Barr's nomination this week after the Senate Judiciary Committee approved it on a party-line vote last week. Senator Paul cited Barr's record on government surveillance, calling him the chief advocate for warrantless surveillance. Despite Paul's opposition, Barr is expected to easily win confirmation. The chamber's more moderate Republicans, like Utah's Mitt Romney and Colorado's Cory Gardner, have both said they'll vote for Barr. Democrat Doug Jones of Alabama also said he'll support him. House Democrats move forward a measure aimed at halting U.S. support for the Saudi-led military campaign in Yemen. Democratic Rules Committee Chair Jim McGovern said it's high time to invoke the War Powers Act, which requires Congress to approve U.S. involvement in military hostilities.
Bombs fall daily. They fall on weddings, hospitals, and homes, even on school buses. And nearly all the bombs say the same thing, made in the United States of America, all during a war Congress never authorized. More than 22 million people are in need of humanitarian assistance, and 85,000 children under the age of five have already died of hunger and disease. We need to reclaim our role over U.S. foreign policy.
Activists who oppose U.S. support for the Saudi war in Yemen welcome the measure, but say it is largely symbolic. Freshman Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar has unequivocally apologized for tweets suggesting members of Congress support Israel because of campaign contributions. Her tweets drew bipartisan criticism and a rebuke from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The Minnesota Democrat said she had no intention of offending anyone, including Jewish Americans. She tweeted, quote, "Anti-Semitism is real, and I'm grateful for Jewish allies and colleagues who are educating me on the painful history of anti-Semitic tropes." At the same time, Omar said she reaffirmed the problematic role of lobbyists in U.S. politics, whether it be AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the NRA, or the fossil fuel industry. Republicans called on Democrats to strip Omar of her seat on the House Foreign Relations Committee. President Trump said yesterday the freshman congresswoman should be ashamed of herself, and he didn't think her apology was adequate. Trump himself drew harsh criticism for saying after the deadly 2017 Unite the Right rally, which included the Klan and neo-Nazis, that there were very fine people on both sides. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today, a conversation on one of the fiercest labor battles in U.S. history. It was the late 19th century, and on one side, there were the rail workers led by a young iconic figure, Eugene Victor Debs. And on the other side, who what we today commonly refer to as the robber barons, led by one George Pullman. It was a time of technological transformation and a time of economic upheaval. In fact, it was a time that may not be so unfamiliar in some ways to our day today. For this conversation, I am joined by Jack Kelly. Jack Kelly is a journalist and a historian, and he is the author of the book on this very issue that we're going to be talking about. It's called The Edge of Anarchy, The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America History. Jack Kelly, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Well, it's great to be with you, Mitch.
Good to have you. I'm excited to have this conversation. Let's begin by just talking about the sort of the scene in 1893. And there's an economic crisis that happens. What's that crisis about?
Well, you know, a lot of people are familiar with the Great Depression of the 1930s, which kind of eclipsed the earlier depression that began in 1893. And at the time was the worst economic collapse in American history and the first really huge collapse of the industrial era. We got a little bit of a taste of it in 2008, had a lot of similarities to the panic on Wall Street, then the credit froze up, and then the banks, a lot of banks failed, businesses failed. But at the time, there was no not only no safety net for individual people, but the government had no idea how to stop it or what to do about it. And it just spiraled downhill, lasted for about 5 years of massive unemployment. And it really spelled the end of the Gilded Age. It was the great boom that had been going on since the end of the Civil War ended in the 1890s. And it was a desperate time.
Help me understand this. This was caused by a rope company that bought all the rights to the hemp coming into the United States?
Well, it was the actual panic on Wall Street was started by the failure of a company called National Cordage, which in fact was trying to corner the market on rope and hemp that went into the rope at the time. All businesses or almost all corporations in the late 19th century, their overweening goal was to have a monopoly. And you see it in oil. The most famous ones are in the railroads, in the oil industry with John D. Rockefeller. But there were many others in the sugar industry and many other industries where corporations tried to pull together a monopoly by forcing competitors out of business and taking over competing companies. And that's what happened with National Cordage. They extended themselves trying to pull together this monopoly. Their business failed. That caused several companies on Wall Street to fail, brokers, and it was like the house of cards came down.
And there's not a whole lot of rules and regulations over monopolies in these things at the time, are there?
There were essentially no rules. They had passed the Sherman Antitrust Act. They were beginning to be concerned about it. And they put through the Sherman Antitrust Act, which later, under Teddy Roosevelt, was used against the corporations. But the government at the time, in the 1890s, Grover Cleveland was just taking over as president, were very pro-business. Cleveland was very pro-business, even though he was a Democrat. And they just didn't have the will to enforce that law until, ironically, it was enforced during this massive labor strike against the union. That was the first time that the Sherman Antitrust Act was enforced because it was considered to be constraint of trade. So
when I was reading this portion just about the economic crash of 1893 and reading about the efforts of these companies to monopolize and everything, I mean, I couldn't help but think about our own tech industry today.
Well, the technology of the 19th century, if you look at it sort of parallel, and it's a little bit hard unless you're into steampunk, I guess, to see the technology of the 1800s is very parallel to what we have now. Great opportunities, particularly in the railroads. The railroads grew after the Civil War enormously. There was a tremendous profit in them, and they attracted enormous amounts of capital. Until they attracted so much capital that they were overcapitalized, they couldn't keep up with the dividends and debts that they had to support. And that was a big underlying reason for the collapse in 1893, was that a number of railroads went out of business entirely or went bankrupt. I guess it would be a little bit parallel to the tech boom, the dot-com boom, that went bust around 2000.
Important to keep in mind how these railroads revolutionized society, how revolutionary they were at the time.
Yeah, it's hard. You know, George Pullman, who made his fortune in sleeping cars, he also produced some other specialty cars for the railroads, like dining cars. But to think today that a man can become one of the most richest men in America by producing sleeping cars for the railroads, it's a little hard to cast your mind back to those days. But the railroads were so dominant. There were essentially no actual roads. You know, it was still the horse and buggy era and wagons. None of the roads were paved. So the way to get around the country suddenly became these railroads. You could go across the country in a week. A tremendous revolution in people's way of life and in commerce in general was revolutionized in the sense of suddenly there were national markets. Instead of a local brewery, you could sell your beer all over the country. Instead of, for example, the meat industry had always been a local industry, local butchers. But when the railroads came in, by the 1890s, three-quarters of all the meat in the country was being processed in these large industrial slaughterhouses in Chicago, and then shipped by refrigerated rail car around the country. And that was something totally new. It made meat a lot cheaper and really changed people's lives.
And revolutionized the economy. I mean, when you talk about the railroads that way, I really do see the connection to how the online universe today has changed the economy and changed how everything, how goods are moved around and how you get them and what's available where. So that's very interesting. Yeah. And so, but this collapse of 1893 occurs smack dab in the middle of the World Fair in Chicago, in which you had people like George Pullman and the other railroad barons showing off this technological advancement. I mean, this whole fair begins with this idea of a new day has come.
The whole point of the fair was to celebrate the technology that was exploding at the time, and particularly electricity. Electric lights and electric power was just starting to come into use. It was a phenomenal number of people. I think about a quarter of all the people in the country traveled to Chicago by train to take in that fair. And some of them mortgaged their homes in order to get there because they said, you can't miss it. The collapse on Wall Street began 4 days after that fair opened. And the plunge into the depths of the Depression was happening simultaneously as the fair was going on during the summer.
Let's now dive into the story of George Pullman and the Pullman Company, the rail company, with this collapse. And he's not the only one that does this, but one way they respond to this collapse in the economy is by shrinking the wages of its workers.
Yeah, and that would have been a common strategy for most companies at the time. There were two peculiarities with George Pullman. The first was that in order to get away from the squalor in the central Chicago, he built what was one of the biggest factories in the world about 15 miles south of Chicago. He didn't want his workers to be exposed to the vice and the tenements and so forth in Chicago. So he built a company town beside the factory, and this was a model town. It was going to be the way the city should be built in the future. Nice, neat homes for the workers, parks, playing fields, schools, libraries. And he ran this company town. He wouldn't sell the homes to the workers. They had to rent them. That was one peculiarity. So when the Depression hit, he lowered the wages of the workers, but he didn't lower the rents. He had this kind of quirk to his personality that he always had to be making money. And he made money off of the workers by renting the homes in the model town. So they were squeezed to the point where workers would work for 2 weeks. And then after deducting their rent, they would get a check for $3. And they had to support their family on $3 for the next 2 weeks. And they became so desperate that it pushed them to the point of going on strike. That was one quirk of George Pullman. And the other was that he, in addition to the manufacturing railroad cars, he operated cars. He never sold in most cases, he didn't sell the sleeping cars to the railroads. He operated them on the railroads as a concession so that you would pay a fare to go from one city to another, then you would pay an upgrade to ride in a Pullman car, which was much more luxurious, much more comfortable, and all the fees for the upgrade went straight into George Pullman's pocket. So from that aspect of the business, he continued to make pretty good money even during the Depression because people had to travel, they had to get around, and they still were willing to pay to ride in a Pullman car. So those two things were both factors in the development of the strike and the boycott and the huge national disruption that resulted.
That brings us to Eugene Victor Debs, which is interesting. We've done shows on Eugene Victor Debs before, but always as a perennial presidential candidate. I think you ran four or five times, one time from a jail cell.
Yeah.
What I appreciate about what you did and what we're going to be able to do in this conversation is to talk about how Eugene Victor Debs became the Eugene Victor Debs that we would know of by his union organizing. He created the American Railway Union. And even before we get into this fight with George Pullman, he has a very important moment at, against another railroad baron, James Hill, and the Great Northern Railway.
Yeah, the Debs had been an official in what was called the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen. The fireman was the guy that shoveled the coal into the burner of the locomotive. And Debs had worked on that job and then became a union official. And there were many of those brotherhoods. The engineers had one, the conductors had one, the switchmen and the brakemen each had their own brotherhood. And they were bicker with each other and undercut each other. And Debs's idea was to have a union that included everybody in the industry. And he figured that if everybody pulled together, that they would have a lot more clout against the railroads who were becoming more and more consolidated. The railroad corporations in this move towards monopoly were becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. And they was hard for any of the one of the brotherhoods to really have much effect on them. So he started the American Railway Union. It was very popular. A lot of railroad workers rushed to join up. Unfortunately, it was just that same year that the Depression began. He didn't have Debs was at this time was still quite a conservative labor leader. He wasn't the radical that he would be noted for later. And he did manage a strike against what they call Big Jim Hill up in the Great Northern Rail Line, which, like a lot of railroads, had cut the wages and increased the work of the workers. And Debs took that to arbitration. And he played the politics of it very well. He got some businessmen from, they were headquartered in St. Paul, and he got some of the local businessmen who were being hurt by the strike to sit on the arbitration board, and they essentially gave the union most of what they wanted. So that was, that made the American Railway Union even more popular, and more railroad workers rushed to join up. And then a couple months later, they came up against Pullman because he wanted, in his inclusivity, he also included workers of any company that had any kind of a railroad connection. So the manufacturing workers at Pullman were also included in the union. They had gone on strike essentially on their own. And the question then became whether the American Railway Union would support them.
And this is important, this victory with the against the Great Northern Railway, because this is, what, 6-7 years after the Haymarket affair of 1886. This is the first time organized labor would get a key victory with through peaceful, I guess, strikes or actions without resorting to violence.
Yeah, that was, and Debs made a great point of that. You know, he saw that if the union was strong enough, labor strife would essentially fade away. That it would be a matter of just negotiations. Workers want something, they'd sit down. The railroads would have no choice but to deal with them. They would talk it out, and they would come to some compromise solution, and that would be the future of labor relations. There would be no need for strikes. He was pretty much thought that the union could become powerful enough. There would be no more strikes. There would be no, this harmony between the company and the union. The success in the Great Northern strike reinforced that idea for him. He thought, well, that's great. This is exactly what I hoped for, to have arbitration, have the compromise on both sides, and everyone benefits. He had that illusion for about 3 months, and he ran up against George Pullman.
Yeah, and the U.S. Army. This is Letters on Politics. We are in conversation with Jack Kelly. Jack Kelly is a historian and a journalist and the author of a book that we are in conversation about. It's called The Edge of Anarchy, The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America. Jack Kelly, before we dive into the Pullman strike of 1894, one last question, because I found this fascinating, just about the environment at this time leading into it, and that's the national scene. There are sort of these uprisings, labor uprisings, happening all over the country in groups, even including from where we're broadcasting from, San Francisco, that were marching on to Washington, D.C. And I want to ask you about one particular group because I found it fascinating. And that was known as, and I may be saying this wrong, so you'll correct me, Coxey's Army, after Jacob Coxey in Ohio.
Yeah, I pronounce it Coxey, but I'm not sure. You may be correct. I'm not sure what's the actual pronunciation of that. But I assure you
spent more time with this name than I have.
Jacob Coxey, I included a description of it in the book, even though it wasn't directly related to the Pullman strike. But it really did, as you said, give a clue as to the atmosphere in the country at the time. Because the government was essentially doing nothing about the Depression and didn't know what to do, Coxey had an idea that was actually very forward-looking and very reasonable, was to hire unemployed men to repair the roads. The roads were in bad shape. A lot of farmers had trouble getting their produce to the railheads where they would ship it out because the roads were in such bad shape. So he thought that would be a dual benefit. It would give men jobs, essentially stimulate the economy, and would leave behind an infrastructure that would basically pay for itself.
This is kind of pre-Keynesian economics.
It was, yes, exactly. Before Keynes, he had the idea of the gospel at the time was you've got to hold more tightly to the gold standard, which was exactly the opposite. You know, tight money was not what you needed during the Depression, but they just didn't understand that. And to issue bonds and to spend money on infrastructure would have helped the economy and would have had these advantages in terms of infrastructure. The government didn't want to hear about it. So Coxey had the idea of getting a group of unemployed men. He lived out in Ohio, and they would walk to the Capitol in Washington and present their demands. And the interesting thing, they actually did walk that entire distance. A lot of people supported them along the way, gave them food and clothing and, you know, put them up at night. There was also groups out in San Francisco and Seattle and Los Angeles that were even more radical but that supported Coxey's idea. They couldn't walk the whole way, so they began to steal trains. And there was some pretty wild.
Really? Who stole trains? And what would happen when you stole a train? Were you able just to?
Well, they had a railroad. A lot of the unemployed men in the West were miners, you know, still left over from the mining industry out there. And others were railroad workers who had been laid off. So the railroad workers were very familiar with how to run a train, and they would just go into a train yard and grab an engine, hook it up, and take off.
Who's going to stop them, right?
Yeah. The government then would get a train and go chasing after them. They had a few shootouts. They had when they got stuck, then they would start walking if they had to. Some of them hired boats and took boats down the Mississippi and then up the Ohio River. It got a lot of press coverage. It was a very colorful episode, the whole Coxey movement, which was taking place March, April, and May of 1894. They did get to Washington, and Coxey was arrested for... They had passed a law saying it was illegal to make a harangue on capital property, which I thought was kind of an ironic law. But Coxey was arrested for walking on the grass of the Capitol, and essentially the government ignored them. But the government was concerned. I mean, the people didn't know. People were afraid. You know, the bottom was dropping out of the country.
Well, the President Grover Cleveland, which I'm glad we get to talk about today, because I think this is one of the presidents most people don't know about, and in his Attorney General, Richard Olney, were both very fearful of a national insurrection occurring.
They handed out rifles to the office workers in the Treasury Department because they imagined that these guys would try to break into the Treasury and loot the vaults of the gold reserves, I guess. It all amounted to really very little when it came down to it, but it heightened the just sense of anxiety in the country.
I feel like we've now spent the time in setting the scene here. Let's get to the Pullman strike itself. It would begin in, my understanding, May of 1894, go till about July. And it began through a wildcat strike. What does wildcat strike mean?
Well, the employees of the factory at Pullman decided on their own that they were going to go on strike. And they were being advised. They were already members of the union, this American Railway Union, and Eugene Debs and other union officials were advising them not to go on strike. And they listened to the advice and then went on strike anyway. So they started the strike. When I was mentioned earlier that they were getting paid $3 for 2 weeks of work. In those days, you know, if you had $3, you had to live on $3, and your family had to live on $3. It wasn't somewhere you could go to get a handout. Men fainted on the job because they would go to work if they hadn't eaten in 2 or 3 days, and the children were going to bed hungry. So there was once they went on strike and were getting nothing, then the union tried to get together a welfare, voluntary welfare support of the, you know, to collect donations and get both individuals and some stores and companies contributed to relieve them of this terrible desperation that they were in of not getting a paycheck. And that strike went on for about a month. And then the American Railway Union had its first convention because it had only been started the year before. They hadn't had a convention before. And delegates from all over the country came to Chicago for the convention. They met and they went down and talked to the Pullman workers. This was obviously a big issue for the convention and what they were going to do about it. And so it was put up to the convention, what action should the union take? The real trouble started when the union voted to boycott the Pullman cars that were still operating on the rail lines. Pullman didn't really care all that much about shutting down his factory because there were not a lot of orders for new cars, but he was making all his money now on operating the Pullman cars on the railroad. And so for the union to stop, the union members to stop handling those cars, would really put the pressure on him to come to some settlement.
And let's keep in mind here what it means to stop these cars. And almost the entire rail system itself was stopped. Is that correct?
The railroad workers knew what they were doing, and they knew how to take the Pullman cars off. And if the railroads had cooperated or just let them go about their business, they would have taken the Pullman cars off. Other trains could have run. But the railroads had decided that this American Railway Union was a threat. So they didn't allow them to take the cars off. They padlocked the cars on. They told the workers that if they disobeyed orders, they would be fired, which they were. Once a man was fired on any line, the other employees of that line would go on strike. And so the strike spread mostly through the West, but also to a certain extent into the East, and shut down every rail line in the country. So that was
And just to keep in mind, as we were talking earlier, how the railroads had completely transformed the economy in kind of similar ways as we've seen the online world transform the economy today. I mean, that's a huge deal.
Yeah, it's interesting you make that connection, because you can imagine that suddenly the internet went out, you know, like, oh, no, I can't order on Amazon. I think the country really woke up in 1894 to how dependent they'd become on the railroads, because suddenly there was no meat available. Suddenly there was no coal available, because coal was any electric plants, and there was just electric power generation was just getting going then, mostly small plants that had to have a continual supply of coal. Those were shut down. Transportation was shut down. A lot of cities out west in particular were totally dependent on the railroad. There was no roads to them. There was no water transportation to them. And once the rail was shut down, they no longer got produce coming in. They couldn't ship products out. People couldn't come and visit. It was quite a dramatic situation for everybody in the country.
And this is how the U.S. Army gets involved. Am I correct? Because on the pretext that with the railroad system basically coming to a halt, now the mail is not getting served and not getting delivered. Hence, Grover Cleveland would order the U.S. Army to intervene.
Right. That was the pretext for getting the Army involved. In fact, the railroad workers were very happy to send out the mail trains and keep the mails running, and were quite scrupulous about it. But the railroads wanted to stop the mails, because that stopping the mail was a federal offense. That would be an onus on the union. They did things like putting Pullman cars on trains that normally didn't carry a Pullman car, just to aggravate the railroad workers and to challenge them. The workers won the strike and they lost the strike. They won the strike because the railroads couldn't maintain being shut down any more than George Pullman could operate his company and not get any revenues. But both of them leaned on the government. The government got involved on behalf of the railroads, and that was what made the difference. And the sending in the troops was part of it. The other part was an injunction, which I shouldn't go back and say. In addition to Grover Cleveland, who was president, he had a attorney general named Richard Olney. And Olney had spent his career as a railroad lawyer. And he was appointed to attorney general. He was still a railroad lawyer. He was a director of several railroads, and he didn't see any conflict of interest. He didn't recuse himself from the affair. And so he, rather than act as the chief justice officer in the country, he acted as an agent of the railroads. Whatever they wanted, he would do it. So he got the injunction, which essentially made the strike illegal. Eugene Debs and other union officials were arrested, and he convinced Grover Cleveland to send in the U.S. Army on the pretext, as you mentioned, of the getting the mails moving. And that eventually decided the strike.
With Eugene Victor Debs in prison, and he's in prison for what, like 6 months or so?
Yeah, 6 months. Yeah. He took the case to the Supreme Court that the injunction was illegal, and the Supreme Court ruled that it was legal and that he had to obey it by not obeying it. He was in contempt, so he served a 6-month sentence.
And he's the leader of this union. Does the union still continue to operate as before without him?
Well, once the injunction was put on, once the troops were sent out, mostly in Chicago, but also out west, there were quite a few troops. Sacramento was a big hot spot for the confrontation with the government. The union, which was so spread out, it was much different than trying to lead a strike in a factory where everybody's together. The people participating in the strike were all over the country. And once Debs was arrested and enjoined from leading the strike, they were essentially leaderless, and the strike fell apart at that point. And the union fell apart, too. That was essentially the end of that American Railway Union.
We'll continue our conversation with Jack Kelly after this musical break. Jack Kelly is the author of the book, The Edge of Anarchy, The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America. This is Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and this is the first of a number of interviews we hope to bring you over the next few weeks concerning great American labor strikes. So we hope you will tune in for that. It's part of our effort to give some history behind, I guess, many of the labor strikes that we're starting to see now, including teacher strikes that are breaking out across the country once again. So we'll return to our conversation after this. Conversation with Jack Kelly. Jack Kelly is a historian and journalist and the author of the book, The Edge of Anarchy, The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America. We are talking about the Pullman strike of 1894. How violent did this strike get? And when did the violence start? Was it already occurring before the U.S. Army was called in?
There was minor sabotage and vandalism. There were a lot of non-railroad workers who were unemployed. There were so many unemployed men in the cities that they would congregate in the rail yards and raise havoc just to express their own discontent. And so they stopped trains. They broke the windows of trains, but no real major violence until around, I think it was the 4th of July, as a matter of fact, that the first troops arrived in Chicago, and that touched off a wave of violence, of which there were probably about three dozen people that were shot dead, and a certain amount of confrontation and violence, not a huge amount. And it's really not known exactly how many people are killed, because a lot of, particularly in the immigrant communities, they would take the bodies away and hide them, essentially, or bury them without reporting it. They didn't want to get involved. So exactly how many people were killed is not known, but it became somewhat violent.
Could we say more than 30 people, do you think?
Yeah, I'd say that would be a good estimate.
Talk to me about how race played into this strike. Pullman, the Pullman Company, was the largest employer of African Americans.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting when you go into American history how this undercurrent of race comes up. And I didn't really, when I started out, think of this as having much of a racial angle to it. But in fact, race became quite important, because one of the things that was being decided at the convention of the American Railway Union was whether or not to admit blacks. There were George Pullman had hired mainly freed slaves to work as servants on the cars that are known as porters. And he was the largest employer of African Americans in the country at the time. If they had allowed those men to become members of the union, they could have much more easily shut down Pullman's operation. But this was one of the real low points in American racial history. Plessy versus Ferguson, which made Jim Crow the law of the land, was just working its way through the courts at the time, and they voted against it. Debs pleaded with them to allow blacks into the union, and they wouldn't. By quite a close vote, they voted not to. So the black workers just stepped back and said, "That's, you know, now it's your problem. We're not going to." In fact, some of them actively tried to take the jobs away from the guys that were striking. And it wasn't until in the 1930s, actually in, A. Philip Randolph started the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, which was the first all-black union in 1925. And then in the 30s, they finally were able to get the Pullman Company to recognize the union and get some relief from very difficult working conditions. And of course, Randolph went on to become a great civil rights leader as well.
That's really interesting. So the union's unwillingness to allow African Americans to join the union in 1894 probably ended up costing them at the time.
Yeah, and Debs recognized that afterwards. He said, you know, that was a crucial decision that could have made the difference, and they could have won the strike if they had chosen differently. And it was unfortunately became a pattern in the labor movement for at least the first half of the 20th century of racial exclusion. They were constantly hurting their own position by keeping blacks out of the unions. And it wasn't really until the 1960s that black people were allowed to have jobs on the railroad. And it was because of the unions, because they weren't allowed in the unions, and the unions controlled the jobs that they were. And of course, by the 1960s, the number of jobs on the railroad was rapidly declining. So they were given access to jobs that weren't there.
And how did Eugene Victor Debs come down on race in America at this time?
He was certainly more far-sighted than most people at the time. He wasn't. He still had certain. You know, he didn't believe in socializing blacks and whites should socialize together, but he was very sympathetic to them. Later on, as he became a socialist after the failure of the strike, he figured that if the government was going to jump in on the side of the capitalists, then we had to change the government. We couldn't just organize labor. And so he essentially became a politician in the latter half of his life. And he turned the American Railway Union into the Socialist Party of America. As a socialist, he sort of went with what I think was a mistaken socialist view that everything is class, that everything boils down to class antipathy, and the racial problem was only sort of a subsidiary to that. For black people, that wasn't true. That the socialist, the working class in America was very racially, had a lot of racial antagonism. It wasn't the ruling class. It was imposing racism on the white unions.
After the U.S. Army puts down basically the strike, that's why the strike comes to an end. Eugene Victor Debs is in jail. The U.S. Army puts down the strike. And initially, it appears as though the strike did not work because workers came back to what they had before.
Yeah, the Pullman workers had to come back on Pullman's terms. They essentially lost everything. A lot of the railroad workers, because of the unemployment, the railroads went out and hired other men and blackballed, particularly the union men and the activists among the railroad workers. So a lot of them also lost their jobs. It was largely a negative result for those particular workers. The shock of the strike, the shock of the violence, the disruption that the strike caused did give an impetus to reforms that came in and really built up to the Progressive Era, which was started around the turn of the century, 1900. And there were railroad workers were among the first to benefit from some of those reforms. They got the right to unionize, and some of the safety regulations were improved, and their work conditions were improved. And there was a lot of legislation that came as a sort of a reaction to the extreme quality of the strike that made child labor illegal, set more reasonable working hours, overtime, minimum wage. That type of legislation came in part as a reaction to the strike.
And then there's this in that vein, there's this federal commission that's created to look into what happened. And this commission actually largely blames the corporations.
Yeah, George Pullman really took a lot of flack from that commission. They said he was, he was backward in his approach to labor, that he should have compromised more, that the model town was poorly run. A couple of years later, the model town was sold off. And it was an ironic end, in a way, paradoxical end to the strike, because George Pullman won, but he was reviled. Even a lot of his friends said he, if he'd been a little more flexible, they could have avoided this whole terrible disruption for the country. Eugene Debs lost the strike, but then when he came out of jail, he came back to Chicago and was welcomed by 100,000 people and was really lionized as the great hero of the strike, even though they lost. So it was quite a paradox.
100,000 people in 1894 is a lot of people. A lot of people today, but...
And Debs was a popular figure for the rest of his life, really. And as you mentioned before, he ran 5 times for president and lost every race. But people loved to hear him speak, and he was a great orator and great... He had a great faith in ordinary people and a great faith in America. And he really was able to put that across, but people would listen to him and cheer for him, and then they wouldn't vote for him. So,
and then a few years later, after this federal commission and the investigation and in the aftermath of everything that happened with this Pullman strike of 1894, Congress would actually pass and help make law some provisions, some new stuff that actually gave better labor protections or at least labor rights to rail workers.
Yeah, there was the Erdman Act, I think, was passed in 1898, and that gave them the right to unionize. The railroad workers went back to the old union model of the brotherhoods, and each individual brotherhood for the different, what they call crafts or the different skills, like the engineer and the conductor had their brotherhoods. And those really have lasted for the rest of the great railroad era.
Is what you mean by trade unions?
They were trade unions, yeah. Correct. Whereas the union that Debs envisioned was what was called an industrial union, included everybody, no matter what their job was in the railroad. They were all in the same union, very much like United Auto Workers. That was the great industrial union of the 1930s. But the industrial union idea, which is always more radical than the trade union concept, had to wait until the 1930s to really take off, even though Debs had this idea in the 1890s.
Well, was Debs a member of the International Workers of the World? Industrial Workers of the World, excuse me.
The Industrial Workers of the World was started, I'm not sure exactly, I think it was maybe around 1913, 14, and he helped start it, that union with the Big Bill Haywood of the miners' union, but he wasn't really identified with what they called the Wobblies, because they believed in what was called the propaganda of the deed, which was essentially violence and bombing and
dynamite.
Dynamite, yeah. and Debs thought it was totally counterproductive. He didn't believe in violence whatsoever. And so he drifted away from them. He didn't turn his back on them, but he wasn't involved for very long with them, and really essentially pursued politics. But I would say he was more of a prophet than a politician. He was a man of ideas. He did, the socialists did take over. I think Berkeley, California was had a socialist government in the 19 teens and 20s, Schenectady, New York. Milwaukee was a big socialist center, and the government controlled by socialists. So there was some local success, but nationally it never really gained much traction.
Jack Kelly is a journalist and a historian. He has joined us for a conversation on the Pullman strike of 1894. Jack Kelly is the author of the book, The Edge of Anarchy: The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. Professor Peter Warren's The Fate of the Ice Sheet on the Top of the World. In early 2019, news about accelerated melting in Arctic and Antarctic made me return to trusted sources. In the most recent TUC program, you heard Professor Eric Vigneault explain the connection between ocean warming and the mass loss of the West Antarctic glaciers. For the Arctic, I return to Professor Peter Wadhams, the UK's most experienced sea ice scientist, professor of ocean physics at the University of Cambridge. In an age of exploration, where computer models often dominate, his research is special because he actually did decades of fieldwork on and under the ice in submarines. As opposed to the Antarctic, that is a continent of mountains and valleys covered in ice, the North Pole is an ocean covered with an ice sheet that touched the coastlines of Greenland, Canada, Alaska, and Siberia for 100,000 years. In only 30 years, the retreat from the coastlines during the Arctic summer accelerated, and an ice-free Arctic in September may occur as early as 2020, and the Arctic winter is no longer cold enough to restore the levels. Peter Wadhams has made more than 50 expeditions to both polar regions. In his most recent book, A Farewell to Ice, he describes in vivid detail the changes in the Arctic and the danger they pose to the world's climate. Dave Ballas runs a YouTube channel that he named Just Have a Think. He sat down with Peter Wadhams in late November 2018 and asked to be brought up to date on the current situation and the prognosis for the future. My thanks go to Dave for his permission to use this excellent interview. Here's Dave.
Well, welcome to Just Have a Think, and I'm very happy to be here with Professor Peter Wadhams. Peter, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. It's a pleasure to meet you. Just for the handful of people who may not be aware of your body of work, can you give us just a sort of summary of what you've been up to and how you got into it and what the main emphasis of your work has been over the years?
Well, I got into Arctic sea ice research kind of by accident. I mean, I always wanted to be an oceanographer, partly because my family had been sailors, but I was very keen on physics at school. So a way of combining physics and going to sea was to become an oceanographer. So when I first graduated, I got a job on an oceanographic ship for a year, and the Canadians were doing the first circumnavigation of North and South America. It's still the only one that's ever been done by a ship called the Hudson. I really wanted to be a traditional oceanographer, which means you sail around in the tropics and sunbathe. Uh-huh. But unfortunately, I got sold on sea ice because we went down to the Antarctic and worked in ice-covered seas. And then we came up back through the Northwest Passage and had a very interesting time getting stuck in the ice.
Right.
And so in those days, there was very few people working on sea ice. The first conference I went to on it, were, I think the entire population of the world of sea ice researchers went to it. It was in wow. Iceland. And they hadn't had a conference on sea ice for 13 years. And so everybody went, and there was only 80 people. That was the whole world population wow. of sea ice researchers. So I was the kind of official university scientist, really, attached to the Navy whenever they sent a submarine to the Arctic.
What do you think, what's been the extent of ice loss since you've been, I mean, you've been looking at it for, what, 40-odd years?
Yes, it's huge. we can always measure the loss of area of ice from satellites because they can see the difference between white and dark.
Yeah.
So it was known that the ice area was shrinking by about 3% a decade, some low rate of shrinkage. But it gradually meant that the summer ice started to shrink back from the coastlines of the Arctic. So instead of even the summer ice cover filling the Arctic Ocean, it was shrinking back a little bit, allowing the existence of a Northwest Passage and a Northern Sea Route, if you're lucky. But then the rate started to accelerate, and nobody had looked at actually how thick the ice was, although it's pretty obvious, really. If the ice shrinks and it has to melt, and if it's going to melt, it's got to get thin first.
Yes.
So
yes,
the average thickness should be going down. So I started asking the Navy to take the submarine over the same track each time. And so we did two tracks that were identical over the Arctic Ocean from Greenland to the pole in 1976 and 1987, so 11-year gap. That gap resulted in a 15% decrease in thickness. So I wrote that up, and that was the first report on thinning of ice in the Arctic. But the 15% was just a starter, because then the next voyage we did in the 90s, it was up to 43% loss of ice.
Wow. Loss of thickness?
Loss of thickness.
Yeah.
And that it's at least 50% now loss of thickness, but because of the shrinkage as well, it's three quarters of the ice has gone. Mm. The downward trend is so strong that it really is going to get rid of all the summer ice very soon, and it won't come back.
Can you give us a layman's sort of snapshot of why that's such a dramatic forcer of the climate issue?
Yes, well, when you have sea ice, especially if there's fresh snow on top, then its albedo, which is the fraction of solar radiation that's reflected straight back into space, is about 80 or 90%. But open water is less than 10%. It's the biggest transition in albedo on the planet, if you have ice, sea ice, and take it away, or snow and take that away. That means a huge amount of extra energy absorbed by either the sea or the land. Just the loss of sea ice is equivalent to adding a quarter to the warming effect of the CO2 we're adding to the atmosphere. And then also we're finding that the area of snow in the northern lands, the Arctic and the subarctic, that's going down, and it's gone down by about 6 million square kilometres. Okay. So that's as big a loss, or even bigger loss, than the loss of sea ice. Mm. So if you add the two effects together, it's now more like 50%, a 50% increase in the rate of warming just due to the loss of snow and ice. So yes. So it's already the case that if you kind of switch on, start your SUV and emit two molecules of CO2 from the tailpipe, then nature or Arctic change is giving you another molecule as well to add to the effect, which is due to the retreat of sea ice. Mm.
Which isn't reflected necessarily in these concentration pathways that the IPCC
uses. The IPCC is very slack in incorporating all these feedbacks. They tend not to do it very well, and so their predictions tend to be complacent, I think, is the word, or false is another word. But this one is, I think, one of the alarming ones, because other feedbacks are things that may or may not happen, like methane loss. But albedo is definitely happening, because we're losing area of snow and ice, replacing it with darkness.
Just a scientific fact. So even in the IPCC report, they've said that the Arctic has warmed by 1.9 degrees Celsius just in the last 30 years. And that's reducing the differential between the mid-latitude warmer regions and the Arctic cold region, which, as I understand it, is having an effect on the jet stream.
It is an effect where it implicates sea ice and Arctic warming very strongly. And the person who originated the theory is Jennifer Francis from Rutgers University, and most people agree with her analysis now that what's happening is the Arctic's warming about four times as fast as the rest of the planet. So the difference in temperature between the Arctic air mass and tropical air masses is getting less. Because the temperature difference has gone down, the driving force for the jet stream is less. So the jet stream slowed down, and as it slows down, instead of being a straight line, it goes into lobes, north-south lobes. Okay. It's like a river flowing over a flat estuary. It tends to meander. So you've got a meandering jet stream, and with a meandering, it means that Arctic air is carried down to much lower latitudes than it should get to. And then in between, there's regions where tropical air is carried to much higher latitudes. So Europe seemed to have escaped this, but beginning of this year, we had this beast from the east, which yes. was exactly this thing, that you had extremely cold air covering Europe and extremely warm air in the Arctic. The Arctic was 30 degrees warmer wow. than normal. In fact, it was above zero at the North Pole. And the problem with all that is these extreme events will keep happening now, because that's the way the jet streams become. We're not going to escape from either extreme heat or extreme cold events during the winter. It's not extreme weather we're getting, it's extreme climate, that the climate has changed. And it's changed in an unpredictable way. These events, you can't predict them, but they have a big impact on mid-latitudes in the Northern Hemisphere. And that's exactly the place where most of the world's food is grown. So therefore, you have revolts and uprisings and warfare even. And you find the years in which food prices are very high are years in which you have the Arab revolt and the big uprisings in Tunisia and all over the Middle East.
So you mentioned earlier about methane in the Arctic, and I've heard about people talking about methane bursts. It all sounds very dramatic. So what that's about and how quickly it might happen, or what the prognosis is for that?
Well, it could happen very suddenly, and I think it's the greatest single threat that we face, but that's not generally recognised by the IPCC. And the origin is this fact that the sea ice is retreating in summer. So what we used to have in the Arctic is a very interesting ocean, because the centre of it is very deep, like most oceans. It's 4,000 metres deep. But it's got the widest continental shelves of any ocean. And so this whole area around the edge of the Arctic, which is the seas north of Russia, basically, the East Siberian Sea, Laptev Sea, Kara Sea, these are very wide shelves. And the shelves are incredibly shallow, only 50 to 100 metres deep. So it's like a swimming pool with a very shallow end and a very deep end.
Right.
So that you've got 50 to 100 metres going out right up into the middle of the Arctic virtually. Then suddenly it goes deep and you have the very deep ocean. Now the trouble is that the summer retreat of sea ice has taken it back into the centre of the Arctic Ocean. So the deep part of the Arctic Ocean still has an ice cover in the summer. But the shelves don't. The ice has completely gone off the shelves. And so we have open water and shallow open water as well. So that means in the summer, when you're getting lots of solar radiation, that radiation is hitting a shallow layer of water and warming it up. So instead of the water temperature staying at zero, which is what would happen in the past when we still had ice, the water temperature has risen to several degrees. 3 years ago, it was 11 degrees up here. So if you look at 11 degrees, that's the temperature of the North Sea in Scarborough, I think. People go swimming.
Not the Arctic.
So with those temperatures, when in the past you always had zero or less, it has a dramatic effect on the seabed, because the seabed is like a pressure cooker. It's got a layer of permafrost left over from the last ice age. That's holding down several hundred metres of sediments which are full of methane. And as soon as you release the pressure, that turns back into methane gas and comes out. We did an analysis in Nature, which was based on an estimate that only maybe 8% of the methane came out. That's still 50 gigatons a year. And that would have an impact, climatic impact, of increasing air temperatures worldwide by 0.6 of a degree.
So, sorry to interrupt, just if I'm right, then the average, the CO2 output at the moment is about 40 gigatons, isn't it? 40 billion tons. And methane is, what, 23 times more powerful than CO2?
Yes, so
and there could be 50 billion tonnes of that coming up.
So that would be a one-year burst that would have an impact at least 20 times the impact of CO2. So it will be a catastrophe because the temperature would suddenly rise. It's not wouldn't be rising smoothly, but it would rise by, even with 8% of the methane being released, it gives you 0.6 of a degree warming straight away. So it baffles me that IPCC has not taken account of that in its assessments.
I know you've been on record as saying that you feel that the prognosis in the IPCC report is pretty woefully underplayed. There, you know, obviously the Paris Agreement was 2 degrees maximum and aspire to 1.5. And then this latest IPCC report has come out. They're saying it's even more important that we now shoot for 1.5 degrees maximum. But it seems to me that looks less and less feasible as every day goes by.
Well, I think it never was really feasible. Even the IPCC's own analysis said we've got to reduce emissions to zero by 2050. And we can't. And they're not even decreasing at all. They're still increasing exponentially. Yeah. The CO2 level in the atmosphere is still going up at an unrestrained rate when the signing of the Paris Agreement didn't produce a sudden decrease in CO2 levels or CO2 emissions. They just kept going up. The world didn't notice. If, for instance, an asteroid was spotted heading for the planet, then the whole world would mobilise to do something about it and kind of launch some giant mass of nuclear weapons to try and divert it. We wouldn't just sit there supine and let it hit us. But because climate change, which is going to be just as destructive, it's going to make human life impossible, but because it will take decades to happen, everybody from day to day can sort of think, oh, I don't need to do anything now. I'll do something sometime in the future. It's a natural human reaction. You really, to face up to this need for 1.5 or 2 degrees restriction on warming, you have to completely trash immediately all fossil fuel power stations.
Yeah.
You have to stop drilling for oil, stop digging coal, get rid of fossil fuel power stations, replace them with solar, wind and nuclear immediately at huge cost, and people will object to paying that cost. Stop people from driving big cars and make it necessary to have an electric car if you're going to have a car.
Yeah.
Change people's lives to such an extent that people wouldn't tolerate it. If there isn't an immediate threat, if there isn't that asteroid heading for us, they won't do anything. So it won't get done, and that's my fear. It's not a fear. I think it's a prediction. We won't see any reduction in carbon emissions. Far from reducing them to zero, it will shoot up to the point where we can't get it back down. And rightly, I think IPCC say, if we don't start to seriously reduce emissions within the next 2 years, we'll never get them down to a level that will save us.
I have recognised that the biggest issue I think we have is getting the message. You put it forward in a very, very easy to understand way, but I've listened to a lot of really technical presentations that you know, and I'm not a stupid guy, I'm fairly intelligent, but I've had to really try hard to understand, and actually even reading the IPCC report, why use one word when 53 will do? It's a very verbose report. And it's almost an exercise in demonstrating one's vocabulary expertise rather than trying to get a message across in words of one syllable. And that's part of the issue.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's really bad. I've always felt that in science, that if you can understand a concept, you can get it across to an intelligent layman. It ought to be possible to explain any concept in science. And if you can't explain it, then it's probably wrong. Made some mistake if you can't get something across. And, of course, scientists don't often like that because they like to be able to maintain the mystique rather than saying something that's that everybody can understand, because when everybody understands it, everybody will say, oh, we always knew that.
Yeah.
Like everybody's saying about the Arctic. We always knew that the ice was going to disappear. In fact, everybody said it's not going to disappear.
Suddenly changed their tune. Yeah. So you're just back from Italy.
The meeting was called by the Papal Pontifical Academy of Sciences at the Vatican Science Group and by the Italian government lab, CNR.
And you were talking about the global sea level rises, so that obviously not an insignificant factor in global warming either. So what's the prognosis for that with the various temperature rises that we are likely to get?
Well, the prognosis, as in most things, seems to be acceleration. All the bad things are accelerating. And the sea level rise is, again, one of those bad things. It's accelerating and it's been underplayed by IPCC. Mm. And again, you can see why. You can say it's for cowardly political reasons, because if you underpredict how much sea level is going to rise, then in the summary for policymakers, then the policymakers can take a lower value for the sea level rise rate, so they don't have to spend so much on raising the heights of flood defences. So it's really nasty and evil, but you can see the temptation for the people who oversee the IPCC reports. That's government people have an input after the scientists have said what they want to say. The summary that goes to policymakers is overseen by politicians, and they tend to weaken the predictions. So the worst case of this was sea level rise. Mm. And the IPCC was predicting in 2007 something like 30 centimetres of sea level rise by the end of the century. So that went out to policymakers. They thought, oh, great, we don't have to do that much. We can just raise the heights of flood defences by
about 30
centimetres. Yeah. but then the last assessment, they took account of the fact that the Greenland ice sheet and Antarctic ice sheet are melting at an accelerated rate. And we now know how fast they're melting, because there's a satellite now, a gravity-based satellite, which measures how much stuff there is underneath it. So as the Greenland ice sheet shrinks, it's possible to exactly map how much ice there is left in Greenland. So that's called the GRACE satellite. It's a wonderful thing. And we now know that Greenland is losing mass at about 300 cubic kilometres a year, and Antarctica is starting to lose mass. It's up to about 100. And that's greater than any other source of water going into the ocean. All the other glaciers in the world are already retreating, and most of them are going. And the warming of the ocean doesn't do that much. It's Greenland and Antarctica that are now the drivers of sea level rise. And the more we measure processes in Greenland, the more we conclude that sea level is rising in an accelerated way, because the melt of the Greenland ice sheet is accelerating. So the warming of Greenland, giving accelerated loss of ice from the surface in the summer, gives you accelerated deposition of fresh water into the ocean, gives you accelerated sea level rise. And so it's again a feedback loop. And it's not easy to get around it. Many people think, if we can deal with global warming and stop the rate of warming, then that stops sea level rise as well. But it doesn't. The sea level rise is partly based, because you're dealing with very thick ice sheets, there's a flywheel effect going on, that once the melt of Greenland gets going, it doesn't matter if we stop global warming. It'll take a long time before the melt of Greenland stops happening, the melt of Antarctica. So the sea level, accelerating sea level rise, will keep on going even if we deal with air temperatures.
So, right.
And the problems there, of course, are loss of coastal cities, because this 30 centimetres has already gone to a metre, and now a lot of glaciologists think it will go to 2, 3, or 4 metres as the sea level rises.
By 2100 or so.
Yes, by 2100.
Yeah, yeah.
So that would be pretty catastrophic. We lose a lot of coastal cities completely. And again, because sea level is global. It's not regional. You're not going to save one place like Miami is trying to save itself by pumping water out to sea, which is a bit like King Canute.
And also higher, presumably, if that higher sea level is a global average across an entire planet, when it surges, when you've got more energy anyway and hurricanes start whipping it up, presumably you've got a bunch more water to surge with. So those surges across cities are going to be a whole lot more dramatic as well, presumably.
I think that's going to be the worst effect. I mean, there was a lot of studies done on storm surges after 1953 floods in the Netherlands and Britain. And because I know about that because, first of all, I was alive. And secondly, my grandparents' house was flooded.
Really?
In Tilbury. And when you look at the sea level rise associated with that, it was a storm surge in the North Sea with a very strong northerly wind just piling water up into the Straits of Dover at a time when it was high tide, and so the water just spilled over. That kind of thing keeps happening, but if it's happening on the basis of a higher average level, then everything is worse. So the only way to stop things being worse is to raise the heights of seawalls around the entire planet to the same amount as the rise in sea level. So that's why it's very important that we get the rise in sea level right, get the predictions right, because that's how much we've got to raise sea walls.
So we build once rather than continually.
I think the planning for London is quite good. They've got contingency plans for building another Thames barrier downstream. And I talked to the person, in fact, I went to a meeting in China with the Chinese Academy of Sciences, which had a British delegation, including the guy who's responsible for the Thames barrier. And the Chinese delegation that was really worried because they were using low values for sea level rise, and places like Shanghai, which is full of canals, they didn't know how much they had to raise the heights of canal walls. Even Britain isn't okay. And certainly a place that hasn't got any sea walls, like Bangladesh, is in a terrible state.
Yes.
It's poor. There's, I think, 20 million people live within 2 metres of sea level.
Right.
As sea level rises, and also you get storm surges in the Bay of Bengal with the wind driving water up into the head of the bay, you get a storm surge. If you have a higher sea level, you get more flooding. So you get catastrophic floods, you already do, around Bangladesh coastline. And people can't afford to retreat because there's another 20 million people living behind them saying, clear off.
Yeah.
And then they can't raise the heights of sea defences, so they just die. Mm. And the frequency of these catastrophic events is going to go up. And that's probably be the main immediate effect of sea level rise is going to be increase of deaths in poor countries because of storm surges.
Yes.
And then loss, and then economically, it's going to be loss of cities in rich countries because you can't maintain them against the sea level rise, like New Orleans or Miami. Mm. That these cities have to be abandoned.
That was Professor Peter Wadhams, sea ice scientist and director of the Scott Polar Institute in Cambridge until 1992, and professor of ocean physics. And thanks to Dave Borlas for allowing me to use his interview with Peter Wadhams for radio. You can see a longer version on Dave's YouTube channel, Just Have a Think. He posted in late November 2018. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
And we're back here on Unusual Sources 93.3 CFMU, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial and the rest of the world via our streaming service online. That's at cfmu.ca. Check out the new website. It's got a page for us, Unusual Sources. You can look us up on the show's page, and archived programs are there, including the Transit Talk episodes, and we're on Kojiko Channel 222 as well. Today, as I said, we have a special guest in the studio with us today, and that is Rabbi David Miviser with Independent Jewish Voices Canada. So, David, thanks very much for joining us right here in the studio.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
I love it. It's always better to have people right here with us, not just for sound quality, but it's easier to converse. And we don't get hit with long-distance charges anymore. We're not allowed to use the phones for long-distance charges after all the calls we made. So that's
I had to travel the long distance to get here. I'm actually from Vancouver.
Right. Okay. So it is a long-distance call. Well, David, actually, yes, it's a very good point you make. I saw you described in one of the articles I was reading as a rabbi now based in Hamilton.
Yeah.
Which is true. And you are doing a lot of activism out there in BC, and now you're here, and you've given a real shot in the arm to the activities of Independent Jewish Voices Hamilton, which has done a number of activities in the last few months. I actually missed one of them. I was not here. I was out of country, and we didn't cover it on the show. But before we talk about today's subject, which is this incredible campaign you've got going with regard to the Jewish National Fund and what Independent Jewish Voices is doing, there was this event in December, which I know some people I know helped advertise, but we didn't get to talk about it. You had a sort of thing going on, Lights for Gaza. It had to do with the Jewish celebration at that time of year, but also was specifically directed towards the children in Gaza. So what is it that you're trying to do with that initiative back in December?
Yeah, so very specifically, it was raising money to buy small solar lamps that are like handheld lamps that are powered by solar power for children in Gaza. And the reason that's important is because the electrical system in Gaza is down most of the time. People in Gaza have very few hours of electricity per day, and they don't even know when it's going to be. So, you know, there's something like 2 million people really trapped in Gaza. They cannot get out. And it's really like a large open-air prison. I've lately been thinking of it very seriously like a concentration camp. Palestinians are concentrated in there, and they can't get out. They can't control so much about their own lives, even like what food they get to eat, building materials, medicine, so on and so on and so on. So also, they don't have electricity more than a few hours a day. So there's hundreds of thousands of little children who are in the dark at night. And I have been involved with, you can say, kind of political advocacy, trying to do things to bring more justice to Palestine and things like that for years and years. And I feel like so often it feels either futile or very long term, you know, maybe one day this will work. And I started feeling like I have to do something to just help people. So there's an organization in California called the Rebuilding Alliance. And I'm saying it's slow and clear, so everybody can look it up on the web if they want, therebuildingalliance.org. And they are among the organizations that are able to get things into Gaza, and they've bought tens of thousands of these little solar lamps that a kid can hold in their hand and walk around their house, do their homework. And of course, the whole rest of the family can too, you know, make dinner, wash dishes, whatever's going on. They need light. And they're relatively inexpensive, like $20 or $25 each. So that's the wind-up. What you asked is, what did we do? So there's a Jewish holiday called Hanukkah that comes at the darkest time of the year, around the winter solstice. And one of the things we do for Hanukkah is we light candles, one more candle every night for 8 nights. So it's increasing the light in the dark. And we thought, what a good thing to do, to have a Hanukkah party and ask people to donate to buy these little solar lamps so that we can increase the light in the dark for children in Gaza. And actually, we did that last year in Vancouver, And then this year, Independent Jewish Voices in Canada did it in four different cities. We did it in Vancouver, Hamilton, Montreal, and Ottawa. And altogether, we raised several thousand dollars that provides a few hundred of these little lamps for children in Gaza. That's what we did.
You know, it's a very sensitive and well-conceived event. And I say it's sensitive because we've shown several dozen films about Gaza in Hamilton as part of various film series. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of them are focused on the children in Gaza and the various occupied territories. And one thing that we see in common that stands out is they lack the very essentials. Every single thing we take for granted is being denied to them. They don't have reliable electricity. They don't have reliable access to healthcare. They don't have schooling that is funded in any reasonable way. They don't have reliable access to decent food all the time. And much of the time is spent, especially after these recent conflicts, sitting in these burned out, bombed out former towns and villages with not a whole lot of things to do. Ditches from bombs full of water. And, you know, it's worse than third world conditions in many cases. So getting even some access to reliable lighting is meaningful and important to those recipients. And also to tie it to a Jewish holiday represents what we've been seeing more and more in Canada, which is there are progressive Jewish organizations that want to bring Judaism back towards what the kind of social justice and rebuilding efforts that you're referring to, and reminding people that there doesn't have to be the kind of relationships that exist, this alleged dichotomy between Jews and Arabs, this sort of false dichotomy, right, that has been created, and the religion can be used for positive aspects. And so, you know, it's part of a much larger thing that's going on in the English-speaking world. If you look at the UK and the US and Canada, which is, there are the emergence of these progressive Jewish organizations. Independent Jewish Voices has been growing, and we've been covering it on this program for a decade. I spoke a few months ago with some of the young people who are doing so much to help expand the efforts of Independent Jewish Voices right now. You know, they told me privately, they said, well, you're really lucky. You've got David Mivesser in Hamilton now, that you'll be able to do more things. And certainly there have been more things happening. And you've been involved in this extraordinary campaign that Independent Jewish Voices has been pursuing for a while. And that has to do with the JNF, the Jewish National Fund. Now, you know, I'm not going to give a lecture on this, but basically for people who might have just been tuning in, they don't know about this. What's the JNF, and why is it a problem that it's had a charitable status in Canada?
Oh, that's a good question. So JNF is the Jewish National Fund, and I'll just say what it is and where it came from, what it does. So about 115 or 120 years ago, an organization was created at a time when most Jews in the world lived in very oppressive conditions. There were millions and millions of Jews who lived in Eastern Europe in, I would say, dire poverty, and also subjected to horrible oppression, just like marauding armed bands would come into their villages and kill people. It was terrible. So the Zionist movement started with the idea of creating a homeland for the Jews in the land of Israel, which is in the Bible. That's where the Jews came from. It's the place the Jews prayed to be able to go. It's even you just talked about this holiday of Hanukkah. So that's where Hanukkah took place more than 2,000 years ago. So the Jews should be able to go back there. And this early Zionist movement around 1900 created an organization it called the Jewish National Fund that people could donate money to, literally like nickels and dimes, but they didn't have nickels and dimes in Poland and Russia. They had other things. But collect the money and collectively buy land. And some Jews could go and live on that land. And actually, I would say that's a fairly idealistic thing. It actually isn't private land ownership. It's not capitalist. It's very collective. And I think if something like that was happening today, I would support it. And actually, in fact, I used to support that when I was a lot younger. But what happened, they bought land little by little, and it turned into something that became very, very oriented toward cleaning out the people that already lived there, which today we call them Palestinians. I think around 1900, they were just people who lived there, Arabs. The whole Middle East is filled with people who speak Arabic. Some are Muslim, some are Christian, some have other religious orientations. But the Jewish National Fund started this attempt really at ethnic cleansing. This is written down. It's in diaries of people. Even the director of the Jewish National Fund from the late 1945, 46, his name was Yosef Weiss. He had a whole plan to how to empty out Arab villages, how to demolish their villages, wipe them off the face of the earth, literally. And in 1948, when the British withdrew from Mandate Palestine that they were given by the League of Nations. This was after World War II. The United Nations was founded. The United Nations voted to partition the land, and the British were going to give up this mandate and withdraw. War broke out. During the course of that war, the Jews managed to get a lot of Palestinians out, like 750,000 of them, from villages and towns and even urban neighborhoods. And then all of a sudden, there was all this like kind of empty land, and the state of Israel that was founded at that time said, oh, these are absentee landlords. Somebody owns it, but they're not here. So they gave that land to the Jewish National Fund to manage, supposedly, on behalf of the absentee landlords. And then after a few years, oh, these people are not coming back. Of course, they couldn't come back. Israel wouldn't let them come back. Some of them tried to come back, and they were just shot on sight and killed. So I'm just going to be kind of quick about it and say in the 1950s, the Jewish National Fund came to own outright something like 13 or 16% of all the land in Israel and control about 90% of the land in Israel. And by its own charter, that land is exclusively for the use of Jews. It is land that the Jewish National Fund owns or manages for Jews. And if you're not a Jew, which fortunately I am, but if you're not, you cannot lease it, you can't rent it, you can't use it. So it's very exclusive. In our language today, we might say it's racist. And it also contributes to – not contributes to, it does. It demolishes villages. It pushes people out of their homes, and it literally wipes them off the face of the earth. The sign that there was ever a village there, and then they very often plant forests on the rubble of these destroyed villages. So if you go back, let's just say 10 years later, it looks like a nice young forest, and you don't realize that there was someone's home there.
Yeah.
So wait a minute. So I'm just going to wrap up what you were asking. This organization still collects donations, and in a number of countries around the world, including Canada, the donations, you get a tax exemption for it. It has charitable status. So a person in Canada could donate like $1 million to the Jewish National Fund and not have to pay taxes on the $1 million, right? So there's an obvious problem there that the Jewish National Fund is doing things that are not only unethical, but they actually violate Canadian tax law.
Yes.
You're not allowed to do these things and give tax receipts for destroying people's villages, for excluding one ethnic group and allowing another one. Canadian tax law is very clear. You're not allowed to do that and give tax receipts. But in Canada, the JNF has charitable status, and it does that.
So many tragic stories contained in what Rabbi Mivasser just said. For those who are just listening, we're speaking with Rabbi David Mivasser from Independent Jewish Voices, talking about a campaign that's going on. We'll be going to be learning about that campaign right now. Because as you said, David, there was these numerous accounts when you read about this issue on Independent Jewish Voices website. They have a nice section for the JNF and news articles. There are people who very young age were donating to the JNF. Just like you said, nickels and dimes going around with a collection box, donate to the Jewish National Fund, had these idealistic notions of what it was. And then they themselves learned later what it really was and became upset. One person who's been upset for a while, according to the CBC article that came out, there's that Dr. Ishmael Zayed. He's apparently had been petitioning to have a review of the charitable status for about 40 years. He's been for four decades saying, hey, wait a minute. The JNF is for Jews only land, And you can't have a charity that's like racist, like you said. That's you can't right. do that. So the Independent Jewish Voices has been working on this issue, and there's been a number of campaigns. So if at the beginning of the year, my email inbox exploded because I'm on the Independent Jewish Voices mailing list, and I suddenly saw that the JNF was now being reviewed by the government and the CRA, the Canada Revenue Agency, and that there had been some other related stories. And suddenly all these emails were coming in, and it made clear that there's been a new initiative or a recent initiative by yourself and some other people to challenge the JNF based on information that was uncovered in the last few years, more about the JNF is involved with the Israeli military. So can you tell us, what is this initiative that's been happening that you've been involved with?
Okay. Well, first of all, Dr. Ismail Zaid was born in a village that was conquered by Israel in 1967. The people in the village never fired a shot. They didn't resist. And after Israel conquered the village, the JNF brought in bulldozers and just totally bulldozed it. It's gone. Like, there were homes, mosques, churches, schools, stores. It's all gone. And this is 1967, and they planted a forest on top of it, and they call it Canada Park. And that was funded by donations from Canada. So Dr. Zaid, who is a retired physician, and he lives in Halifax, like you said, for 40 years, he's been writing to the Canada Revenue Agency, the CRA, about this, and got absolutely nowhere. So in October 2017 – he and I and two other people filed a formal complaint with the Canada Revenue Agency. We detailed in an 88-page document, completely drawn from Jewish National Fund sources. We didn't – I mean, you said we uncovered things. It's been available. It's just right there in their own sources. I would say more, we compiled it. We looked at Canadian tax law. There's five different provisions of tax law that they're constantly violating. We documented it. We filed it. We personally went to Ottawa and met with the director of compliance in the charities division named Robert Delaney, gave it to him, talked with him for 2 hours. That was in October 2017. We don't see any outcomes of that whatsoever. So in early January, we filed a formal legal parliamentary petition. And I say we initiated it, but it had to be submitted by a member of parliament. And what a parliamentary petition does, it's a great kind of new thing we have in Canada. If 500 Canadians sign it within 120 days, it gets submitted to Parliament, and Parliament has to consider it, and the government is obliged to respond to it. So we wanted to get 500 signatures, and we got that within 24 hours. It went up on Parliament website about 11:30 on one morning, and before 11:30 the next morning, we had the 500 signatures. And this is a petition asking the Minister of National Revenue to do an audit of the Jewish National Fund and revoke its charitable status. I want to say it's fake. It's bogus. It's undeserved charitable status. So there's a petition. Like I just said, we got the 500 signatures. It's on Parliament's website. It will be reported to Parliament after 120 days. That'll be in May 2019. But the more signatures on it, the more weight it will have. And I feel very pessimistic about this petition in and of itself, moving the Minister of National Revenue to actually do this. I think the government will likely finesse it. They'll respond by saying something, but they won't really do much about it. So instead of having 500 signatures, if we had 5,000 signatures, it would demonstrate to members of Parliament and to the Minister of National Revenue that Canadians actually are losing faith that the government is dealing with organizations in an impartial way. Like, the Canada Revenue Agency is not enforcing our tax laws in a very political way. Some organizations get cracked down on and put out of business, and others are just allowed to go on violating the law. So this, so for people to sign the petition is a way to demonstrate that they care about this and they want our government to enforce our law.
Yeah, I mean, I know you feel pessimistic about it, but this is more progress than has happened in years. And it's thanks to independent Jewish voices, Jewish people working together with Palestinian diaspora and other people here in Canada. So
that's right.
That is a pleasing result in and of itself. And
that's right.
You know, there's been greater awareness raised, and there's been seemingly these other effects. I know that there was another charity, the Beth Oleth Charitable Organization, yep, that's being reviewed now. Looks like they were giving charity to the Israeli Armed Forces construction infrastructure projects, and you're not supposed to do that, obviously. It's not charitable donation to give money to a foreign military, but that's been going on apparently as well. So, I mean, you got to admire the chutzpah of at least the JNF that gives all these gala dinners, you know, and they go around, Hamilton, Toronto, suit and tie, you know, and 24 Sussex Drive. Meanwhile, they're in contravention of Canadian law for 40 years, contravention of international law. Ishmael Zayed pointing that out, but it was more lone voice than he is now. And that's why we have to work together on this.
That's exactly right. Thank you for saying that. And I am confident that if we keep it up, more and more people will learn about it. One of my hopes is that it'll become something that the donors they'll feel ashamed. Like I used to give to it. I'm a rabbi. I used to speak about it from the pulpit in a synagogue, encouraging people to support it. The more I learned, the more I started questioning, and eventually I got to like a breaking point where I just can't do this anymore. So I don't know what the government's going to do. I don't think our government is actually very concerned about justice and ethics, but people can kind of defund it by stopping there are donations. And I want to get as many signatures on this petition as possible. I'd like to just say what people can do. So any Canadian citizen anywhere in the world and anyone who's a legal resident of Canada, just go to the website of Parliament, Canada Parliament, whatever website, look for the e-petitions. And this one is number E-1999. And just you have to sign it. And if you sign it, you'll increase the influence that it'll have.
You had a Quebec MP sign on to that. That's right. Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned this where can people go? Because there's probably direct links to this. I imagine the Independent Jewish Voices website is telling people where to go on that petition. Right?
I'll say where to go. Yeah. So if you want to – not just the petition, but if you want to learn more, I mean nobody should do anything just because I said so, not even because Brandon Stone said so. Go and learn about it. So go to www.stopthejnf.ca, stopthejnf.ca. And you can see our entire 88-page document that we submitted to the Canada Revenue Agency. You can see links to many other organizations. You can learn a lot. And there's a link to the parliamentary petition website. And I said to Brendan before this program began, I don't want to just talk about it. I'm looking for behavioral outcomes. I am hoping, you know, that because we're talking about it today, the number of signatures on that petition is going to go up.
Well, I think we can help get this around. For example, in the anti-war coalition, we had a petition for Ahed Tamimi, backing her cause. And actually, that got around. And I think with the events that are coming up and website updates, we can put more reference to this petition. I think if it can make a difference to have 5,000 instead of 500 people. We want people to go. So this is like a motion or a movement. It's E1999.
That's it. It happens to be 1999. That's just what it is.
It's really easy to remember. So
if you go there, you'll see petitions about all kinds of things that Canadians want their government to do. Some petitions have six signatures. Few of them have over 1,000. And last time I looked, we are over 1,800. So it would just be helpful. It would be helpful to have Canadians of all walks of life, all ages, to sign. I am motivated by wanting justice for Palestinians. I'm very motivated by that. But you could not care at all about Palestinians and care only about the impartial enforcement of Canadian tax law. For one organization to violate the law for years and years and years and get away completely free. They raise about $30 million a year. Their donors take that off their taxes, and they just get away with that year after year after year. You could do this just on the basis of our government needs to enforce our laws. It's not fair to not do that.
Yeah, the CBC article that came out around January 4th or so, it was even-handed but still pretty scathing about just how seemingly illegal this all was, you know? And, I mean, that's now it's caused quite a stir. This whole thing, I mean, with the after effects on other related charities and so on, it's amazing to watch, and it all happened very quickly. So I think it's something we want to be involved in. I can help put out the word, and we can mention it more, that people should be involved in 1999, and they should be signing that petition. And I know, David, you know, you feel a little like the Canadian government isn't so interested in justice, and that's probably the case. But the pattern overall is that the Canadian people have been well ahead of the political leaderships in all of the parties. Some parties are more responsive than others. The Greens and, to an extent, the NDP have been listening a bit. Within the NDP, for example, we've had a lot of discussions about how the membership has been much more pro-Palestine in terms of looking at ending the occupation. The leadership has been so slow to move, and there's going to have to be movement in leaderships or on the political scene at some point to reflect all this.
That's so true. So you just mentioned the NDP. So the member of parliament who submitted this petition, otherwise it wouldn't be there, is the NDP critic for national revenue. He's the NDP MP who's supposed to be on top of what's up with our taxes. And he's doing his job.
I know, right?
This is it.
Wow.
His name is Pierre-Luc Dussault. And he was, I think, the youngest person ever elected to parliament. I think he was 19 when he was elected, which is just neither here nor there. It just says something about him as a person. But so I would assume he didn't make that decision on his own to do that. He probably discussed it with some of the NDP leadership. And in the past, the NDP has had leadership that I think would have suppressed this, and now the NDP leadership is not exactly jumping up and down waving a banner for us, but they're letting this go on, at least. And that does show movement in Canadian politics. So hopefully, you know, if enough people express themselves about it, the political leadership will realize this is a smart thing for them to go with. And I mean, with all my cynicism about the Liberal Party that's in power now, I think if they saw, wow, 5,000 people signed this petition. Oh, yeah, it's really important that we have fairness in our enforcement of tax laws. So they'll all of a sudden kind of jump on the bandwagon and enforce it.
Well, you know, there are times when it's worth getting involved in the political sphere and talking to the politicians. And there have been successes on Palestine. So let's watch it unfold. Be sure to go to the Independent Jewish Voices website because it does have an excellent section and even a video about the JNF. Try to get on the mailing list. All sorts of amazing updates. This campaign started to move fast at the beginning of this year. So we will give you links to the petition or how you can get involved in that on the online program. So again, Rabbi Miviser, thanks very much for coming and joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.